I think we will go ahead and get started. First thing I'd like to do is take roll, and as usual, if some of the A participants come in after I've done this, I'd appreciate if you folks would tell them to let me know. Ms. Anawati, Baldwin, Bodiger, Brunson, Drager, Ellison, Gamache, Gillis, Heck and Liable.
Mr. Chairman, I have some information regarding Mr. Heck and Liable. Mr. Heck and Liable today is undergoing brain surgery for a tumor. On his behalf, he hasn't been here all week.
Right.
I think it's going to be cost of that. And on his behalf, what I respect the request is that he be able to have been considered to have joined all objections that have happened to this date, and if there's no objection from Powertech that he would join at this date, that he would join any future objections that were made for the record, because it is only due to his situation that he was.
Any objection to that, Mr. Main?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Best, Ms. D?
No.
All right, with that, we will have that as a standing objection together with yours.
And making the statement. Thank you, sir.
Ms. Henderson?
Yes.
Mr. Hickey?
Yes.
Ng? Ms. Jarding will not be here, she told us. Johnson? Camera.
Here and tired.
Kinshiro. King. Klocek. Knudsen.
Here.
Lees.
Here.
Lord. McLean.
Here.
Parkhurst.
Here.
Cheryl Rowe. Roger Rowe, Somerville,
Rose.
And Mr. Upton. Well, I believe, Mr. Iverson, we will go back to your cross.
Thank you.
Good morning.
I'm going to jump back for just a moment. We eventually looked at, if we not, the series of minerals that are on the list that would be part of the anticipated land application. That would be part of the anticipated land application disposal. Do you recall that history, sir?
Yes.
And I think one of the elements or the minerals that you expected to would like to be able to spray on the land in that disposal method would include selenium. Is that correct? I think that was one of the ones on the list.
Selenium is on the list as possibly being in the land application component. Yes.
Right. At this point, we don't know for sure.
We don't know for sure. Yes.
All right. One of the things, though, that you mentioned was that chlorine was going to be somehow involved in the solution to that. Maybe could you explain a little bit more what stage or stages that chlorine would be involved?
You mean chloride?
Or chloride. Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Chloride comes off the resin. It's an indicator that we use in monitoring for excursions.
Does it have anything to do, from a chemical standpoint, you being a chemical engineer, with any of the binding to the resins?
What chloride does is it displaces uranium from the resin.
Okay, how does it attach, though? I mean, is it naturally part of the uranium, or what? Maybe you could explain that.
Well, it's an ion exchange process.
Okay.
So what happens with when you have a higher concentration of one of the other in solution, for example, If you have uranium loaded onto your resin, you have to have a large concentration of chloride, and that will displace the uranium from the resin.
Well, but chloride is not naturally found, and you don't anticipate to find it attached to the uranium that you want to attach to the resins initially to be taken over to the satellite or the plant to be processed.
No, chloride would be the initial form of the resin before it's loaded with uranium.
So it helps the uranium attach to the resin initially? Is that what it does?
No, when uranium is loaded onto the resin, chloride is displaced and comes off of the resin.
Is there any chemical process, or what is the process by which the uranium is initially attached to the resin?
It's ion exchange. It's just, I don't know how to explain it to you better than that.
It just does?
Well.
I mean, do you put the resins down in the ground? Is that what you're doing into the water?
No, the resins are in our ion exchange columns.
Okay.
And so when the solutions flow through, for example, when we're loading the column or the bed of ion exchange resin that's in the column, uranium flows through in high concentrations. It displaces chloride, and the uranium loads onto the resin.
Now, when these solutions have come up and go through these places where this attachment takes place, does it attach to any of the other minerals or elements that are anticipated to also come up in the solution? Does it attach to vanadium, selenium, or arsenic?
Does uranium attach?
No, not uranium. The chloride. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
The chlorides are generally non-reactive.
Okay, to anything else other than uranium? Or
basically, yeah.
What about the other nucleotides, radon?
What do you mean nucleotides?
Well, I mean the...
Do you mean radionuclides?
Thank you.
Radionuclides.
Okay. And there are some others that would be anticipated to be there besides uranium, is that right?
There, in solution, there could be other radionuclides, yes.
And does the chloride then attach, have it, or the they attach to the resins? I mean, is there any interaction that goes on?
Other radionuclides attach to the resin,
okay.
When just like uranium does.
Okay. And then the chloride is used to detach them? Is that what happens?
That's right. And when we regenerate the resin, we take the resin out of the column, okay, and we put it in what we call a Lucian column. And there we take a more concentrated salt solution, circulate it through the resin, and that displaces the uranium.
Does it have any? Does chloride play any role in the creation of the yellow cake beyond that?
It's not really considered a. It would be, if you had too much chloride in the yellow cake, that would be a penalty if you sent it to the conversion plant. So you generally try to remove the chloride from the yellow cake.
You try to remove it. What happens to the rest of the chloride? Are you saying you get 100% of this chloride off of the uranium resin?
It's not necessary to get 100% off.
Okay.
Just get it below the standard for the conversion plant.
Okay, and then what happens to the rest of the chloride?
That's disposed of or recycled.
Okay, well, disposed of, how would you dispose it?
It would go to deep disposal well.
If you get the deep disposal?
Yes.
Otherwise, it would go into the settling ponds?
Yes.
And then the idea of the settling ponds is that what the water is evaporates and you then pick up the solids that are left?
We don't have settling ponds, if you know what I mean. The disposal system, we don't have. There are no evaporation ponds or settling ponds in our design. So for wastewater disposal, We have in the central processing plant, we have a storage pond. But for wastewater disposal, we go to radium settling ponds. That settles out the radium.
Okay.
And then we go, after that point, the water is essentially treated, and it goes to storage ponds, and then it's land applied.
And
our alternatively, it goes to the deep disposal well.
Okay. And as I understand it, if the deep disposal well is not approved or not found feasible to do once you test to see if it is, then the other, and really the only other option that you would be asking the boards to approve would be for disposal of all of that on the surface.
although that waits.
I'm sorry, can you just say the question again, please?
If you don't get approval for the deep disposal well, or you get a permit to dispose the waste, but then it's determined to be infeasible.
Unfeasible.
I guess which word. Unfeasible.
We say not enough capacity. No.
Well, okay.
Same thing.
Then the alternative is everything goes on top of the ground that you are not able to remove from what you call wastewater.
We land apply. There are limits on what we can land apply.
Sure. And then what happens with the worst of the worst stuff?
What do you mean worst of the worst?
In other words, you pull out. You try if you only have an option land application. If that was given to you, you don't do everything. You don't just put everything then on the land, do you?
No.
Okay. You try and remove. When I say the worst of the worst, I mean the most toxic, the most carcinogenic substances that remain. You try and lower the concentration that's in the water that you're going to spread.
The treatment process we propose are for removing radionuclides, because that's what we see necessary.
So what about, say, selenium, and, for example?
Those could be possible that we would have to use those, but what we have, there are limits. Basically, the concerns you heard about bioaccumulation earlier, there are limits that basically are set close to baseline for soils, vegetation, wildlife, livestock, pond water as well. So if there's increasing trends, or if these things significantly vary from baseline, then we have to take corrective action. It includes all manner of things, such as there's a list in the actual groundwater discharge plan application. Corrective action can be adjustment of how you land apply. It can be it can include treatment if necessary. Yes.
Would it be fair to say that it gets more costly as you determine that you have to remove more and more of the worst of the worst?
It could be more costly, but we can apply it if it's not meeting the limits.
One final question on this area, then I'll leave it, about chloride. Does chloride, is there any particular form of chloride that you would be using?
Well, it's sodium chloride is what we regenerate the resin with. So it's the same thing as table salt.
I heard your testimony, sir, with regard to questions for Mr. Hickey. PowerTech, as it stands now as a company, does not have a buyer for even a single pound of Gilliken. Is that right?
We do not have contracts for sales right now.
Okay. And would it be fair to say that you would not guarantee to this board that any of the uranium produced at this proposed site would remain within the United States for United States nuclear power uses?
Objection. This was covered on cross-examination by Mr. Hickey, I believe, in detail.
I think I'll let the question stand at this point.
Our product, it could be sold basically to other countries, which are acceptable under NRC regulations for use as nuclear fuel. So we would ship it to a conversion plant, either Port Hope or Metropolis, Illinois, and eventually it could end up as nuclear fuel in a country that was permissible for us to sell it to.
Did you testify at your deposition, sir, on page 84, that we will not guarantee that it will be used within the United States, that that wouldn't be reasonable?
Yes, that's what I just said.
And I think that while you don't have current buyers, you have partners who are buyers of uranium, is that right?
Synatom uses uranium, yes.
And what about Azarga?
I don't know if Azarga uses uranium.
That's the Hong Kong-based company.
Yes, I believe they're a mining company, whereas Synatom, they provide services to nuclear power plants.
You say you think they're a mining company. Do you know whether they buy uranium?
I don't know.
Okay. In August of this year, they bought about 17% of the company.
I believe that is correct.
Okay. Yeah. And then a few weeks ago, there was a press release, was it not, in which they gave about $3.5 million to PowerTech to further bought into the company.
That's correct. Yeah.
And that money was to be used to ensure that PowerTech had enough money to get through the permit process, according to the press release, etc.
I don't think they said that in the press release. No.
How much money does PowerTech have aside from that $3.5 million right now?
I don't know.
If this board or the DNR at some point were to decide that a $200 million bond was appropriate through closure, well, the NRC would decide that. Could you afford that right now?
I think $200 million is too much based on our estimates that we have done for this project. That would be many, many times, maybe more than 20 times more than what we've estimated already. So
the answer is no, you don't have the money. You just think that's too much and you'd like a lower bond to be set?
No, that's not my answer.
Okay.
I'm just saying the number you used was extremely high relative to our project, relative to the estimates that we have done and provided in our applications.
So Azarga, a Hong Kong-based company, is increasingly buying up PowerTech. From what you told us, Abhinav, is that you think this is a mining company primarily?
I understand that their business is mining. I don't know all the things that they do.
Was part of the deal with the earlier 17% of PowerTech, did that include a major ownership share in the Centennial project, what's left of it?
They did buy a large share of Centennial, yes.
In essence, though, sir, you're not trying to tell this board that PowerTech's operation or proposed operations has anything to do with America's energy independence efforts?
No, I think that it would be very likely for us to get contracts in the United States for sales. I think that's the most likely scenario. And I think that's, personally, my belief is that having more uranium mines in the United States is good for our energy independence. And I think nuclear power is a positive thing. And I think that we rely very heavily on exports for this. And I absolutely think it's a good idea.
So while you now say that you think that there will be a bunch of U.S. contracts, you know, as we just talked about a moment ago, you said it wouldn't be reasonable to guarantee that any of this uranium would end up in the U.S. Isn't that right?
It would not be reasonable because there's a lot of nuclear power plants outside the United States which could be sold to.
And there's a lot of uranium that's being mined all over the world, is it not?
That's true, yes.
What is the current price of uranium, sir? Do you know?
I don't know the current price.
During your deposition, that was back, I think, August 1st of this year, you testified it was $40 a pound, or less than $40 a pound?
That sounds about right, yeah.
Do you know what the break-even price would be for PowerTech's operation to make sure that it had sufficient money to operate the entire project, including to post whatever financial assurance would be required so that we would be left with a fully restored reclaimed area?
Can you break that question down in at least one part at a time, please?
Let me put it this way. What does the price of uranium have to be so that PowerTech can meet all of its financial obligations with regard to the project, start to end, to leaving and being done, and still make a profit.
You're talking about the short-term price that you just referenced, correct?
Well, I referenced the price.
Are you talking about the short-term price?
I'm talking about the less than $40 a pound is what it was August 1st. I'm asking you, what does the price have to be so that PowerTech can meet all of its financial responsibilities from construction to reclamation to monitoring over the years and bonding? What does the price have to be so that PowerTech can make a profit?
There is not a price. The price that you're referring to, spot price, does not dictate economic viability of our project, if that's what you're alluding to. So that's dependent on contracts, which we make, typically long-term contracts, which are typically well above the spot price.
So for the long-term economic viability of this project, you need to have long-term sales contracts, correct?
That's the standard procedure.
Okay, and now you have none.
That is correct.
One of the things that is involved in the applications that PowerTech has proposed to do is I think you just talked for a little earlier about some of these ponds that PowerTech needs, settling ponds. I can't remember the other one.
I said, okay, there's the radium settling ponds, yes.
And these settling ponds, it's proposed would have liners under them, is that right? To protect contamination of the groundwater.
Yes, there are liners. And leak detection systems as well.
Okay. Now, but as to these liners, I think we heard in Mr. Ming's opening statement that the PowerTech, or maybe I'm mistaken, but the PowerTech proposes liners that would last for 20 years, the full lifetime of the current expected project, is that right?
The specification that's in our pond design report, I believe it's 20 years, requirements are that they last the life of the project. And that's readily achievable and has been done many projects. So high-density polyethylene liners are known to last a long time. That's what they're made for.
Does PowerTech currently have a certificate of guarantee from any liner manufacturer that guarantees a minimum of 20 years life?
We have not purchased liners at this time, so we have not pursued a guarantee because we have not begun construction. But I'm sure you can find those warranties from companies.
You would agree that it is not the Clean Water Alliance's job to convince this board that you can actually get a liner that lasts 20 years and have a contract to do so.
Objection, argumentative.
I will sustain the objection. Well.
What is the price of uranium that is used in the projections provided in the application for tax revenues that are anticipated for other things that are supposed to be benefiting us, state, locally, from a beneficial standpoint? Is it $40 a pound?
$65 a pound.
So that any of the supposed tax revenues that would be projected to come to the state if you got your wish list, we're about, two-thirds of that right now for the price rating?
Objection. This is beyond the scope of the direct. This witness didn't testify as to socioeconomic benefits.
He is the master of the application.
I'm going to permit the questioning.
Well, you know, our project life is, just production life is 9 years. So, you know, this, on the average, your price that would apply to the project or the life of the project would be 5 years in the future. So $65 is commonly used in people's economic studies for economic assessments. That's why we've continued to use $65, because it's looking forward.
Is that like in the various models that have been put together on this project? They're all based upon assumptions that may not have real-world bases?
Objection, argumentative.
It's cross-exam. I'm going to let the question stand.
You know, I would add that there's not real. That's not totally correct, because if we go back to a few years prior, the price was considerably higher than $65 per pound. In fact, it reached over $130 per pound. So the selection of our number, as I told you the reasons before, while the price may be lower now, it could easily be a lot higher in the future as well.
It went down quite a bit after the Fukushima incident, didn't it?
No, that's not my understanding of the reason why it dropped. I believe it was decreasing well before that time.
Because there's too much supply already mined. So the price, I mean, a supply and demand idea.
Mr. Allison,
dropping, is that right, sir?
You need to hold on.
I'm sorry, sir. Did you hear my question?
No, I didn't hear a question there.
All right. Price of uranium also depends upon supply and demand factors, sir.
That's true, yes. Okay.
And I think you said the price has been falling even before Fukushima.
Yes.
And then took a big drop after that.
I don't know if it was a big drop after that. I'm not sure. I do believe it did drop some, yes.
I mean, it's like PowerTech stock. It's now down 6 cents, and it was over a dollar for a while.
Well, we don't have an operating mine at this time, so.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
Sir, you mentioned that visiting with Mr. Hickey about some of the contractors that you use, and I think, if I remember right, he had a contractor by the name of Knight Piesel for a while, in 2008. Is that right?
Yes.
And they did some. They did two pump tests for you.
Yes.
Okay. And they, I think, did you say that they also write applications? You know, one of the things that that company does is it can help uranium mining companies write applications for submission.
Yes, they were helping us write applications.
But then they were let go and WWC was hired.
They were not necessarily let go. They did not continue writing our applications. WWC began writing our applications.
And that was because WWC has what you felt better capabilities of handing, dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's so that the permit would look sufficient on its face, better than what Knight Piesel could do?
Well, it's crucial when you have these documents to do them properly, and that's a key thing, to doing them correctly, making sure that everything is in order, and if you don't have those things organized well, you have a real hard time getting through the regulatory process. And there was a vast improvement with WWC when they started doing this. And it really made all the difference for us in this area.
I mean, you were having problems getting the agencies to say yes to your applications, and then there were a whole bunch of recent amendments, and that was WWC's worth?
No, the fact is that understanding what the application is back, the ability of the regulators to use the application to review it, I believe they made that easier so they could do their review.
Well, Knight Piesel helped prepare the initial NRC application, did they not?
Yes.
And then that responsibility, as well as the applications before this board and the mining board, were taken over by WWC.
Yes.
And essentially then that allowed, and NYPISO also did some of the pump tests to study the geohydrology of the area in 2008, correct?
Yes, they did pump tests.
And by hiring WWC, basically what it is you have somebody else who then comes to interpret NYPISO's work for purposes of the board and any other studies that were done of the geohydrology of the area, etc.
Some understand that WWC did any interpretation of the pump test.
Now, you mentioned to us, sir, that one of the reasons why you did not do more detailed pump test analyses of the area was because the NRC would not let you. Is that right?
The pump tests were sufficient. NRC stated in the SCR that the characterization that we did with those pump tests was sufficient. So there was not a need to do more pump tests.
In other words, they said that you met some kind of a bare minimum? Is that what you're saying they agreed to?
They did not use those words.
You were not prohibited at all by the NRC to do further investigation so that this board and the mining board would have a much more detailed site methodology in determining whether to issue an application. Isn't that correct?
Can you say that again?
Sure. You said that the NRC basically said, okay, well, you guys gave us enough. That sounds more like a bare minimum. Correct?
They said it was sufficient.
Sufficient. Okay. You would agree that more pump tests would give much more detailed information about the geohydrology, the specific geohydrology in the area. Isn't that correct?
The way that these mining operations are done is we do general characterization in order to prepare for our application submittal. And then as we do each well field, that would be considered well-field development, which NRC guidance prohibits. We would do pump tests for each well-field, well-field-specific pump test, where all the monitor wells are in place, and those pump tests are generally not allowed because, I mean, they're not allowed at all by federal law because it's part of well-field development, and that's how the procedure is understood to proceed.
Isn't it a fact that the only thing that New Reg 1569 prohibits is actual well field development? It doesn't in any way limit the amount of investigatory testing that you can do.
I don't know that.
Okay. In your deposition, did you not state that New Reg 1567 and New Reg 1569 give special guidance? And about the extent of pump tests and other tests to determine regional hydrology?
It does talk about that in there.
And did you not also testify they let us do some investigation when it's minimized on page 65?
I don't know exactly what I said. I mean, that sounds right.
And that the only limitation, in fact, was the actual well field development. Isn't that true?
Yes.
In fact, New Regs 1569 at section 2.7.1, characterization of hydrology, states that the information that you must provide must be, quote, sufficient to establish potential effects of the in-situ leach operation on groundwater resources. Isn't that right?
I don't know exactly if that's what it says.
Okay. If that's what it says, you wouldn't disagree with that, right?
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Okay. Your pump tests were not... Basically, here we get down to just somebody saying, well, is this enough or is that enough? It's fair to say that your tests only involved a general characterization of the area.
I think it's safe to say that it was sufficient characterization for NRC to say that it's okay to proceed.
In your deposition, you testified that you not on page 66. What we essentially did is enough tests that we thought was sufficient, and then you got the agency to say, okay, well, that's enough, right?
We thought it was sufficient, and they thought it was sufficient.
And any more detailed tests will come only if you get a permit, correct?
That's right, because the NRC does not want us to do more tests.
Could you show us anywhere where you got a limitation document from them that said, hey, you know, I know you guys are eager to really give us site-specific data, but we're not going to let you do any more? Did you get any correspondence like that or communication?
I don't have any direct correspondence. There is a new reg on construction, which this would be considered, and my understanding is that's how they would interpret it. That's our understanding.
There's nothing in that new reg that actually would limit you from having done further testing, isn't that right?
I don't know, but I think it possibly does not limit the testing.
And jumping back for just a moment to WWC and NIPSO, it's a fact, is it not, that you felt or others felt within PowerTech that NIPSO did not have the ability to prepare documents like Jack Fritz does over at WWC?
Who?
Jack?
No, okay.
All right, let me read this.
I missed the first part of the question.
At your deposition, you testified, did you not, that one of the reasons why NIPSO was let go and WWC hired was because NIPSO, quote, did not have the ability to prepare documents like Jack does at WWC Engineering.
I believe I said that, and I believe we've covered this already.
Right. And I think what you liked was that they had really good abilities to prepare the documents.
Yes.
Okay. And they were doing a better job than what you thought NIPSO would do.
Yes.
Page, Council, that you were just reading?
93. Also, Council, you can keep it 37 through 38. Those were all from there. We had a little discussion yesterday about the aquifer exemption, maybe more than a little discussion. Remember that?
Yes.
All right. The primary reason why PowerTech is pursuing an aquifer exemption is not due to the water quality currently, is it?
No, it's due to the presence of the ore body.
Because that might, under the rules and regulations, statutes, that might be non-potable extent of any of the waters that PowerTech wants to mine, that would be a different reason to apply for an aquifer exemption, would it not?
Well, I think you might be mischaracterizing it because, the limit of 10,000 parts per million TDS is usually what they use for characterization as not a USDW. So you're confusing drinking water standards as far as EPA regulations, as I understand them. And they're standards of what is a USDW, which is, I believe, anything that exceeds 10,000 parts per million TDS.
Did you state in your deposition on page 73 that water quality within the aquifer is not the primary reason for them to exempt the aquifer? The reason for exempting the aquifer is the presence of an ore body that can be mined?
Yes.
So I want to spend some time looking at the applications for appropriation of water in the groundwater discharge. And perhaps it would be helpful, sir, if you would have those documents in front of you. And I apologize, I don't have the exhibit numbers, but I can get help perhaps from Council for DNR, Mr. Main. Do you know whether you have any of the, for example, the Eden Care or the Madison Appropriation Water?
Which one would you like me to get?
Let's start with the Indian Care application to appropriate water.
Hold on a second.
But if you could also then please get, and I really do appreciate Council's assistance, the Madison as well as the Deans. Well, I'm talking about the application itself, not the. That would be helpful, not the attachments.
Yeah, this is off the record. Why you?
Okay.
I think what we'll do is maybe take about a 5-minute break while they get things sorted out. I know Miss Gamache came in. Have any other A's come in? All right, thank you, Ms. Allison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mays, with your counsel and counsel of the DNR's help, we have tried to identify the areas that we're now going to address and open them to the beginning pages. What I'd like to start with, if you could please grab the appropriate one. I'd like to start with the application to appropriate water regarding the Indian Care.
Okay.
To the Indian Care. Thank you. Could you please give us the exhibit number of the application? It'd be on the upper right-hand corner. Is that the little sticker?
One. It says water rights one.
Right. No, there's a little sticky thing that's put on the top of the upper right.
Yeah, that says.
Okay. What does it say?
I said water rights one.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. And at least for the water rights applications that were submitted by PowerTech, there were many parts to it, but one part included a shorter application form. Is that correct? Like a 3-4 page document.
Yes.
And then there was a longer report, or what would you call it, that kind of outlined all of the things that PowerTech was going to do to support the application?
A report.
Okay. And then there were, of course, attachments to the report as supporting documentation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Well, let's start with the first application itself, having to do, that is with the Indian Care, is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And if you'd please look on line 2, line number 2 of that first page.
Yes.
Where it says amount of water claimed.
Yes.
You see that? And it has a place for CFS, cubic feet per second.
Yes.
And place for ground GPM, that's gallons per minute.
Yes.
And a place for acre feet.
Yes.
Okay. And is your document the same one that I have that was signed by Mr. Blubaugh on June 6th of 2011?
Yes.
All right. The places where it says amount of water claimed, cubic feet per second, gallons per minute, and acre feet per year, those are the blank on the application, are they not?
Well, those spots don't appear to be filled, but there's a paragraph down lower that explains the withdrawal rate.
Well, it talks about net withdrawal, but it doesn't talk, that's in number 7. In number 2, it doesn't talk about, those portions are not filled in, are they?
Those blanks are not filled in.
Okay. Since you reviewed the application, aren't you supposed to fill in all the blanks?
The statement down below covers those blanks, I would believe.
You didn't say anywhere, like you do somewhere, you say, see attached reports. You didn't say for number two, you didn't say see paragraph 7 below, did you?
No, we didn't say that. It says it follows the end of the items here.
Is it PowerTech's contention that the amount of water claimed is the same thing as meaning net withdrawal? Is that what your contention is?
It is the 274.2 acre feet per year.
There's nothing referenced about the 8,000 gallons a minute or 8,500 gallons a minute on line two, is there?
That's explained in the report.
On the next page, item number four, having to do, and again, next page of the application, it says supplemental information. We see that? Are we on the same page?
Yes.
Okay. Paragraph number four under supplemental information states, does it not, if the proposed water system contains one or more storage dam, please furnish the requested information below for each dam. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, in this process, the overall process, right, the proposed water use system, that's your whole water use system, right? You would agree with that?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
All right. Well, it says, if the proposed water use system, your whole mining operation, the reclamation, and even the transfer of the beads from the satellite facility over to the central processing plant, ponds, pipes, you know, pipeline connections, it all involves a water system, isn't that right?
If you're saying all those things are part of the water system?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And it asks for information on the application, paragraph four, such as height, preliminary outlet capacity, spillway capacity, slope, surface area impoundment. Those are all left blank on the application, are they not?
I believe there's some information, but this is in our large-scale mine application.
Okay, but not in the application for appropriation to appropriate water within the state of South Dakota for the Union Care. Is that right?
These are not storing water as it's produced. They're storing wastewater, these ponds. So,
if the proposed water use system contains one or more storage dams, that doesn't say non-waste dams. It just says storage dams, isn't it?
I think that depends on how you want to interpret it.
And PowerTech interpreted that it didn't have to fill in blanks.
I believe we consulted with DNR, and they agreed with that as well.
Okay. So the DNR instructs you not to fill in portions of the application, is that what you're telling us?
Objection asked and answered.
Who in the DNR instructed you?
Objection.
Well, yep. Just a minute, Mr. Allison. I think it has been asked and answered. So I will sustain the objection.
Who in the DNR, sir, has advised you not to fill in paragraph 2 on the first page, amount of water claimed, or paragraph number 4 on the supplemental information?
We asked the water rights staff, Kim Bueller and Eric Cronland.
Is there anything in writing, sir, where they said, you know, you don't have to fill that in?
I don't know if there's anything in writing.
Okay, so let's now look at the report itself. If you would please look on page 11 of the report.
I'm going to interject here. You're looking for exhibit. It's a separate market.
Oh, thank you, Counselor. Sir, would you please go back to the very beginning of the report and give us the exhibit number for this, for the report itself?
Water Rights 3.
Okay. Thank you. All right, so have you found page 11?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, you see the paragraph that begins table 2-1?
Yes.
Okay. I'm a little curious about 1, 2, 3, The fourth sentence in the middle of that paragraph C where it says during aquifer restoration. You see that?
Just right in the middle, yes.
Yes.
Okay.
You see that sentence?
Mm-hmm.
It states, does it not, during aquifer restoration, PowerTech USA proposes to pump up to 500 gallons per minute from the Inyankara aquifer. Is that a typo? Should that be a lesson? Or is this really that the restoration process is also going to include pumping 500 gallons per minute from the Inyankara?
That'll be recirculated.
What it says proposes to pump up to from the...
Yes, up to. Correct. Okay. Yes.
Is that a typo? Is that supposed to be the Madison, 500 gallons per minute from the Madison? Or did you really mean the Inyankara?
That's from the Inyankara, yes.
And it says the restoration bleed will vary between 1% to 17%?
Yes.
Why the variance? Why that range?
That was to count for the 70% counts for the groundwater sweep, if we were to use groundwater sweep.
Okay, and does PowerTech plan to use, what's the purpose of groundwater sweep?
That's basically, it pulls harder. It increases the bleed so that we pull in harder. Yeah. So our proposed method, which is be recirculation with reverse osmosis with 1% bleed, but we provided for the option of doing groundwater sweep.
Is the higher percent, is that more like using a bigger broom? In other words, if you...
It would be where we would inject a lot less, obviously. And so you would pull harder from outside the formation. Or outside the ore body, excuse me.
This 500 gallons a minute, would that be from one well or would that be from all the wells?
That would be the wells that are in groundwater restoration, aquifer okay. restoration.
So a particular well field?
A particular well field.
That's a lot of pressure that puts on the aquifer when you pump that rate, isn't it?
No.
If you'd look, please, on page 37, the same exhibit, the second full, or I guess it's the first. But on that page is the second full paragraph. It begins with the shale and mudstones.
Okay.
Yes, the
shale and mudstones.
Yes, pardon. If you please look at the last sentence in that paragraph, if you please read that to the board.
Detailed pump test to be conducted after an NRC license as part of the wellfield hydrogeologic packages will provide additional quantification of the low hydraulic conductivity of the confining units.
In a more simpler form, you hope that, first of all, you're going to do a detailed pump test because they're what gives you geohydrological information, correct? After you get the license, and that what you're hoping is that it will show that in fact the Fall River and the Lakota Formation are as isolated from each other as you would like NRC and Fort Lee, etc.
For the most part, yes. Confining units are not mandatory to operating the well field.
Well, the more leaks you have between two aquifers, the harder it is to contain the mine operations, isn't it?
Not necessarily, no.
You're saying pumping two... So if two aquifers, you're mining them at the same time and they leak between each other, you're saying that's containment's not a problem?
You know, situations like that have occurred in the past, and as I said earlier, our primary form of control of wellfield solutions is the bleed, where we continuously have inward flow at all times to the well field. So confining units essentially provide extra protection.
Well, we know there's open boreholes, right, between the aquifers.
There is at least one case that we know of.
And you haven't checked the others, so you really don't know how many there are.
We've looked for these things, and we don't see the signs of them. But we will check again.
After you get a permit.
When we do the well-filled hydrologic packages, which are submitted to DNR and NRC for review.
If you please turn to page 51 of the same exhibit, water rights. Do you remember yesterday what you, how many wells you told us, domestic wells or livestock wells, were in the immediate area?
I believe I didn't know the number of the total wells in the project area. Okay.
On page 51 of this application, there is a table 1, reference to table 1 on appendix B, summarizing the well inventory.
Yes.
Okay. And how many domestic wells does it list as currently used or can reasonably be expected to be used for drinking water use?
Within what area?
Well, on this table, it says table 1. This is the well inventory for, let's see, within 1.2 kilometers of the project.
Okay, so this is not necessarily within the project area, project boundary. This is includes 2 kilometers outside of the project boundary.
So we're including within 2 kilometers, that's less than 2 miles, right?
That's 1.2 miles, says here.
If one were to take the project boundaries of Dewey and Burdick, what's the, how many miles is it from one end to the other?
It's several miles. I don't know.
6, 7?
I would say around that, yeah.
Okay. So what they're asking for is up to a little one, you said 1.2 miles outside of that?
Outside, yes.
Okay. So within all of this collective area, as was submitted, PowerTech submitted in its application, how many wells does it state on this page, Table 1 and Appendix B, are used, are characterized as domestic?
18.
And then below that, there's a what is described as stock. Livestock is the sole use. Is that what it says?
Yes.
Okay. Watering of livestock is sole use. How many wells are identified in your application?
43.
The next part on that same page talks about Table 2 in Appendix B. You see that circle very bottom?
Yes.
Okay. And these are wells that have been identified as historic records, by historic records?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, one of the things that PowerTech did was it went and looked and tried to gather some data about maybe what might not be apparent on the surface, but what historically might the records might show exists. Is that right?
Yes.
And in this table, it states, does it not, or in this part of the page, that wells identified in historic records that were not evident on the surface. That's what Table B is. Table 2 is, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you wrote that several are suspected to be plugged in again.
Yes.
All right. You don't know.
We don't know.
Would you agree with me that the more wells that go in between the Inukare and the Fall River, that that would also affect the ability to control, especially if they're unplugged, that would affect the ability to control the mining solutions?
An unknown well could have that effect. That's why we do pump tests and check for them.
And that PowerTech plans, if it gets a permit, to try and locate such wells and then detect if there's potential impacts.
Yes.
So you're not coming to this board and saying, give me water, let me do land disposal, let me get a mining permit. Here's all the data that shows exactly what the potential, you know, what the interconnection is between these aquifers. Give us a permit, we'll go find it.
Objection. We've been over this. The witness has testified as to the procedure that is used to try to locate any communication between the aquifers a number of times.
I'm going to sustain the objection.
I will move on, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. If you'd look, please, on page 58 of the same permit. You found that page, sir?
Yes.
All right. I'd like you to look, please, at the second full paragraph above where it says Table 6.1, 6-1.
Okay. The paragraph I found it. Yep.
Okay. Very good. This talks about diversion, a diversion report. Could you please describe for us what this is about?
It's the number and location of pumping wells to be operated during the next year.
Okay, and diversion means the diversion of water from what it naturally does?
Well, I'm not sure about that definition of it, but diversion is the term we use for where the, you know, the well. So
okay, that's what it is for once.
I guess so, yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
I just wanted to understand what your definition is. So we're talking about diversion of water by using a well.
That's right. Those are well. Those would be the same thing as a well.
And I noticed in the application it says the plan diversion report will typically be accompanied by an amendment request.
Yes.
Okay, to change the number and designated wells. Is that as the well field is developed?
Yes, our well fields, rather, as you go through the well fields, and they're developed sequentially.
And these are like, these are then post-license operations, et cetera?
Yes.
All right. It then names the statute, SDCL 46-5, 14.1, correct?
Yes.
Which specifies that an amendment of an existing or permit or license may be granted for a change in use. And then only if it does not unlawfully impair existing rights and is for beneficial use and in the public interest, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Once you have your permit, sir, can you please tell us how the public will have any involvement in discussing, challenging whether it's in the public interest?
I'm going to object. The section cited by counsel expressly states that an amendment is required to make the change in place of use or change in location of use. That's subject to notice and public hearing pursuant to code.
I'm going to sustain the objection.
I just wanted that object's position. Wonderful. Thank you.
I would also add, I think it's quite a bit beyond the scope of the direct examination as well.
I would agree it was beyond the scope of direct. However, since it involved the term public interest, I thought it was important to explore what citizen input may or may not be allowed. Okay. And if I may ask, Mr. Chairman, just one more question regarding this. Is it then PowerTech's position that every time you move to amend to expand or add a well field, you're going to give us, the public, notice that you intend to do that so we can start this process and discuss it with the board?
The PowerTech will follow the law. When notice and hearing is required, that's the procedure we'll use.
I'm going to sustain the objection.
If you would, sir, now go to the Madison permit to appropriate water, and if you would be so kind as to give us the exhibit number of the application itself.
I'm sorry, I forgot my glasses. Water Rights 1B.
Thank you. I'm not sure.
There's no 1B.
18. Sorry, as I said, I'm coming across this. Apologize.
I had that problem yesterday. I don't know if you can share.
Especially when it's dark.
Cindy, maybe, or perhaps we can put the lights up, and then if there's something, since I don't know that the board can actually read what's on there anyway, perhaps we put the lights up, and then if there's something specific we need to point to, but if you please be so kind as to follow us along in case there is an opportunity. Thank you.
That's fine.
Yes.
It did to me yesterday.
Okay. So, again, please, what was that exhibit number for the application? So
18, water rights, 18.
Okay. And this time on that second line where it says amount of, or paragraph number two, where it says amount of water claimed, that's actually filled in, is that right?
Yes.
And then we go to the next page of that same exhibit. Again, going down to paragraph number four, water storage dams. If the proposed water system contains one or more storage dam, please furnish the following. See that, sir?
Yes.
And again, that is not filled in on this application.
No.
And then if we could go, please, sir, to one of the introductory pages, Roman numeral 5 of the well, maybe I've got it. What is the exhibit number of the report that accompanies the application for the Madison Water?
I think you're looking for exhibit 20.
Thank you. That's a report thing?
Yes, sir. All right. Now, if you go to please Roman numeral 5 of that report, see that, sir?
Yes.
All right. And the top, this is, I think, the whole page is entitled Executive Summary.
Yes.
All right. In the second sentence of that first paragraph, would you please read that to us? Beginning with the permit to appropriate. First paragraph,
second sentence?
Yes, sir. The permit to appropriate?
The permit to appropriate water from the Madison Aquifer is one of several permits required for PowerTech USA to recover uranium in the Dewey Burdock Project, which is located about 13 miles north-northwest of Edgemont, South Dakota.
So, by this sentence in the application, PowerTech acknowledges that just simply having an NRC final draft license from the staff is not enough for you to start.
Correct.
A little further down, sir, if you look in the 1-2...
To use the water, construction could begin.
I see. So to recover uranium, you feel that means what, when you actually turn the pumps on to start taking uranium out? Is that what your position is?
This would be necessary for operation.
And construction isn't part of operation?
One could build things, but not operate. But still, to operate, you need to have all these permits.
This says that is a permit required to appropriate Madison Water, so perhaps then you need those other permits first then before you even need this permit?
I meant other parts of the project. So you couldn't build a well. You couldn't build a Madison well.
Okay. So, in other words, you would be okay, for example, if this board wanted to defer a year or two while you do some construction and then come back and see whether it's appropriate to issue this permit?
No, we would not.
You want the water first, right?
Objection. Yes. Okay. Argumentative.
All right.
Sustained.
Look down, please, in the third paragraph, middle of that paragraph.
Oops. I'm sorry.
Of the same page, I'm sorry.
I thought you were...
Oh, no, I'm not done. We've got a few things to talk about in this paragraph.
What was the page again?
Page, room number 5.
Okay? You see that third paragraph beginning with, because most of the water removed? You see that paragraph? Third paragraph.
Okay. Yes.
I'd like you to look down, please. I guess it's about the third sentence or so that begins with the bleed stream.
Yes.
All right. And if you could just read that sentence by itself.
The bleed stream is treated to remove uranium and uranium decay products and disposed in deep disposal wells or by land application.
Okay. And I don't want to beat a dead horse to death, but I just want to make sure that our position is clear. Disposal method has not yet been finalized.
We have not received permits for disposal method yet.
And you haven't come to this board and just said simply, we want to do this. You've come and said, well, we want to do this. We want to do deep well disposal, or we want to do land application, or we really want to do both. It's kind of, you haven't picked one and then...
Objection argumentative.
Well, I'm going to sustain the objection. I think it's been covered.
All right, let's do this. If we go again, you mentioned that the EPA has a separate permitting action. Is that right? Next sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Okay.
My apologies. You want me to read the next sentence?
Well, I just want you to look at it, first of all, so that we're talking about the same thing.
A separate permitting action? Okay, we need to look at it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this sentence says as well that once the necessary permits are received, testing can be undertaken to determine the feasibility of constructing deep disposal wells. Correct?
Yes. The Class 5 permit is a construction permit.
Yes, it is a construction permit. Have you applied for a test well permit?
I think that's essentially a test well permit. For all intents and purposes, it would be considered the same.
Well, but you're asking for a permit to dispose of waste down there. And you're saying you have to test first to see if it's even feasible, correct?
Objection. I think this area has been covered in detail.
I mean, what I'm trying to show, Mr. Chairman, to make sure it's really clear what is pre-testing. And I realize we touched a bit on this, but we haven't touched on the application. I want to make sure the board understands just exactly about this. And I can move on, perhaps.
I'm going to sustain the objection. I really do think it's pretty very clear to the board.
I think you told us yesterday, did you not, Mr. Main, that, PowerTech's primary goal in aquifer restoration was to restore the baseline?
Yes.
I'd like you to look on page 9 of this same application. Did you find that page?
Yes.
Would you look, please, at the third paragraph that appears starting with each ISR wellfield?
Okay.
Would you look at the last sentence and then read it to us, please?
The primary goal of aquifer restoration will be to restore the groundwater to baseline, parentheses background, or a maximum contaminant, it's a mistypo,
okay.
Level, MCL, whichever is higher.
Whichever is higher.
Yes, that would be essentially the drinking water standard.
Okay. So you're saying that if the drinking water standard is higher than the baseline, you're going to restore to the higher value? Is that what you're saying?
That says if let me see here. If the baseline, how do I put it? It's basically we will store it to baseline or drinking water standards, whichever one's higher. So if baseline is higher than the maximum containment level, that would be the standard. If the maximum containment level was higher than baseline, that would be the standard, which is essentially drinking water. So there wouldn't be, this would be essentially, if the waters, any of the specific contaminants were drinking water, we would not have to restore below the drinking water standard.
So you're saying the levels that we're talking about, baseline levels, doesn't say requirements, does it? It says you want to restore to the highest.
It says levels. Whichever it's higher, drinking water or baseline.
Whichever is essentially the most contaminated.
Objection, argumentative.
I'm trying to understand what it means.
This is prior to operations. So contaminated.
Just a minute, Mr. Hayes. I'm going to overrule the objection and let the witness answer.
This is prior to operations. So it's not contaminated. MCL is a term used in the drinking water standard.
It says the primary goal of aquifer restoration is after you're done mining, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But the goal baseline is before operations.
Okay, I understand that. But you want to restore to whichever the highest level you can, rather than simply restoring. If baseline is lower, you want to go to the higher level, because that's what you say, right?
It's the higher level of the two. So if baseline is higher than drinking water, that would be the standard.
And if baseline is lower than the maximum contaminant level, you're going to go higher.
Objection asked and answered.
I would agree. Sustained.
All right. Would you agree, sir, that the Inankera, along with the Minnelusa and the Madison and the Deadwood formations, are the four principal aquifers for major sources of water supply in the Black Hills region?
Let's see, you said Inankera,
Minnelusa,
Madison, what was the other one?
Yes.
Deadwood. I know we said what those were. I think that's correct, but talking about the major aquifers of the area, I think you're correct.
Yeah, the four principal aquifers. If you have any doubt, look on page 26 of your original hydrology.
Okay.
I'm not trying to trick you on that. I just want to get it out.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And you want to mine the Inankera, right?
Yes.
And you want to put waste in either the Minnelusa or the Deadwood.
That would be deep well injection, yes.
And the Madison's in between those.
That's correct. I thought we covered that before.
Let's talk a little bit about aquifer flow. I don't think we've talked about that, have we?
No.
Okay, away from the mine site. Would you agree, sir, that the four principal aquifers, which we just talked about, flow from the project area initially to the southwest, correct?
Objection. I think this is beyond the scope of direct.
Oh.
I'm going to sustain the objection. I think PowerTech is going to have a hydrologist later, which would, this line of questioning would probably be more appropriate for a hydrologist.
Well, without getting into much further detail, this witness did oversee the preparations of the applications, and with the board's permission, I'd like to show a map that's contained in the application.
All right, that'll be
fine. That can be done with the hydrologist that we'll be calling as a witness.
I think as part of the application process, this witness can testify without going into a lot of detail.
First of all, you agree that in the application it states that the water turns then southeast as it flows away from the outcrop and around the southern Black Hills?
Where are we at in the application?
Page 32.
Excuse me?
Page 32.
Yes.
Okay. And I think then there's a figure that's on the next page, 33, that actually shows then that the water flowing project area and actually going east.
Yes.
Okay. And as the waters then flow east, they flow south then into Fall River County, and then they flow east through Fall River County. Isn't that correct? They may be broader, but they do include that.
I believe that's generally correct. I mean, the rate of groundwater travel there would add is extremely slow.
But it would mean that people who live in central and eastern Fall River County would be downflow from the way these aquifers flow, however fast or slow it actually travels.
I don't know if that's an accurate representation or not, okay. The way you're saying it.
If you look, please, on page 36 of the application.
Again, are you referring to Exhibit 20?
Yes, I'm still on the same exhibit. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I flipped to page 36.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, page 36.
Okay, sorry. Now I'm getting confused.
Okay, sure. We'll take your time.
Go ahead.
There was some contact with the Edgemont City about over their wells, wasn't there, by part of some of the work that was done up to this point?
I'm not sure what you mean by, you talked about taking pressure readings?
Yes.
Yeah, that was it possible to put, you know, shut in a well that has 100 feet ahead on it, or I think it's more like 100 psi of head at the surface. These little wells, you know, shut them in so that you can measure what the water level is. I mean, and there's concerns that that would ruin the well because those are very old wells.
Okay, in fact, the city wouldn't even let you, they declined your request. Over concerns that increased pressure if you were to do tests would damage the well casings.
Yeah, because you basically, to do a test of the water level on when you have these highly artesian wells, you've got to shut them in and leave them shut in. So this is like some old steel casing. So that's, it's very understandable that they didn't want us to do that.
Okay. Let's jump over a little bit, talk about Madison and the Minnelusa. On page 46 of the same exhibit, under the section 3.4.5, aquifer mixing.
Okay.
You found that, sir?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And this section states, does it not, that as a result of geochemical analysis of the groundwater, numerous wells and springs in the region, and the complexity and karst zones and brachial pipes and dissolution networks observed extensively in the Madison Minnelusa formations around the Black Hills, that it is apparent that some of these features facilitate hydrological cross connections between the Madison and the Minnelusa. That's what it states, does it not?
That's a regional description. Okay. So that's regional, not necessarily within the project boundary.
And if you were to put waste in the Minnelusa and interconnected with the Madison, that would be an example. You know, that's where the hydraulic cross connections are important. Is that right?
Like I said before, for us to get Class 5 disposal well permit approved, it has to be shown that that's not possible, that it's not possible to have this cross-contamination into a USDW. That's requirements of that permit.
If you look, please, over on page 50 of the same exhibit, when PowerTech did its modeling of the Madison Formation, when it was determining its drawdown analysis, it assumed that the Madison was, in fact, a confined aquifer. Isn't that right?
That would be better to ask someone who's coming up after me who can talk about this directly, but that is my understanding.
And that's
they could answer a lot better than me.
Okay, and that's literally what's in the application, though, is it not on that first sentence of under 4.1, analytical predictions?
Yes.
So we know it has interconnections, but the modeling that was done assumed it didn't. And that was homogeneous.
Yes, I believe this is similar to the engineer's report as well.
Okay, and in fact, as it also states, again, the aquifer is neither infinite nor homogeneous.
On a regional sense.
And you don't know what it is locally?
We have an idea what it is locally from geophysical logs.
In fact, further down on that page, it talks in the last paragraph, it talks about figure 3.6, and again, a presumption that the Madison is highly confined.
Where was that again?
The last paragraph, same page.
Oh, sorry.
Based on figure 3.6, it is also presumed the Madison is highly confined?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, if you went to the board and said, hey, instead of presuming that it's highly confined, if you went to the board and said, well, it intermixes a lot, you'd probably get a clear no for using the Minnelusa for disposal.
Objection is argumentative, and this board does not deal with the disposal wells. That's EPA.
Okay. I'll sustain the objection.
But regardless of who deals with it, the assumption was contrary to what is generally existing in the Black Hills. The assumption of highly confined is contrary to what exists elsewhere, everywhere else.
Objection asked and answered.
I'll let him answer again.
There are local data that strongly point to that confinement and show that confinement. There are local paired Madison and Minnelusa wells that show differences in potentiometric surfaces. So these are wells that are screened in the Madison, discreetly in the Madison and discreetly in the Minnelusa, and they're right next to each other, essentially, you know, twin wells. And we can observe, and those have been observed by DNR, they're part of their database. I believe there's at least three pairs of these in the area, and they show a separation between the potentiometric surfaces. I believe it's for something like 20 years at least of data there. So there's strong indications of this, and I shouldn't use the word indications, strong demonstration of that confinement already.
So you don't need to do more tests.
Tests are required, will be required as part of the permit.
I'd like to turn my, I think my last area that I'd like to address. Has PowerTech provided any of the two agencies in the DENR, Water Management Board, large scale, Minerals Board of Environment, with its calculations and the basis for those calculations to determine if Powertech operates for 20 years, gets its entire wish list fulfilled, what will it cost to reclaim this area, to restore the water, reclaim the land, basically protect everything for beneficial uses? What is the cost, and what is that based upon?
Financial assurance estimates that we have provided so far are based on the first year of operation. They do not. They're updated annually. So it's typical you bond 1 year ahead of your next year's activity. We did in the interrogatories estimate those for the life of the project. And if you look in that response, our estimate was $27 million.
And how is that derived?
Just like we derive the financial assurance estimates, which are based on there's considerable guidance on these, but it's complete reclamation, surface reclamation, decommissioning activities. It's complete groundwater restoration for all the well fields, and it's monitoring programs as well.
Would you agree with me that it is not unusual that the bond estimates are inadequate to really cover full restoration?
Objection. We can talk about specific sites, specific instances, but in general, it's hard to address that. Okay. It's vague and okay. Indefinite.
I sustained the objection.
At the Smith Island Ranch, there was a dramatic increase in the bond demanded by the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality because the bond well into operation was determined to be grossly inadequate. Isn't that right?
I don't believe that's correct, but I have read some of those documents, and I believe they estimated three pore volumes for restoration. Pore volumes. And it was requested they increase those to six pore volumes, and thus, you know, that's basically double restoration that they were originally bonded for.
Do you know what the original bond was?
I don't know the exact amount, something like that. Yeah.
$35 million.
Something like that, approximately. Yeah.
Now it's exactly. Now it's 80.
Correct. And if you look at that increase in pore volumes, from three pore volumes to six pore volumes, you know, I don't know the details of this, but I can see why it was doubled. But just so you know, our estimate is at six pore volumes. That's what we use.
And in fact, the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality wanted $150 million, but the company complained it was too expensive.
I don't think that's correct. I think that they probably, the desire there was, some of that letter says they should pay very high labor wages, things like that. And I believe that, and I believe it's been accepted, the revised amount by DNR. That's actually been completed as part of their settlement agreement on that issue. And I believe that they've, you know, they're as allowed as well to continue expanding well fields and operating that project. So I believe they met all their requirements. You have to keep in mind that that project is, I think, at least 30 years in operation, something like that. So they probably didn't have as large of requirements dating back to those years. And they had to increase them to more current levels.
If at the end of Powertech's operations, when all the Canadians go home or everybody goes out...
Objection.
If, when the end of this operation occurs, if Powertech has not restored this mined area, this plant area, and the bond, you know, back to where it's supposed to be, and the bond is inadequate to do so. Who pays for that?
This objection is cause for speculation.
I'm going to overrule the objection. I think you can answer if you can.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question.
Has PowerTech committed itself and all of its worldwide assets to the jurisdiction of the state of South Dakota to ensure that additional funds might be available to pay for those costs?
Objection. The financial assurance will be subject to the jurisdiction of the state of South Dakota, and it will be set at a level that does all the reclamation and restoration required.
Right, but
I'm going to sustain the objection.
Right. But if it's not enough, who pays?
Asked and answered.
I'm going to sustain the
objection. No further question.
Thank you, Mr. Ellison.
Thank you.
Why don't we take a 10-minute break, and then we will begin with other eight interveners. Yes, Ms. Mayne.
Mr. Chairman, I need to clarify. I misstated that there's a notice and hearing when you change a diversion point. I was thinking of changing of beneficial use. But under 46.513.1, that can be done, I do understand, by the chief engineer if he finds that there's no interference with any other diversion. So, but the other part of my statement that PowerTech will follow the law stands. And I think we indicate Mr. Mays had been asked for the authority of why he says the staff issued NRC license is effective, regardless of whether the Atomic Safety Licensing Board hearing has been held, and that I'd last ask the board to take judicial notice of 10 CFR 2.1202A. And that's 10 CFR section 2.1202A. And with that, I should mention the provision for obtaining a stay is 10 CFR section 2.1213. So I'd ask the board to take judicial notice of those two, of that law.
Okay. So
thank you.
Mr. Chairman, so if I'm understanding Mr. Mann correctly, there is no public notice and input for the amendments that discussed with Mr. Mays, and that is PowerTech now taking the position that once it gets that perm, that whatever comes out from the NRC in December, that it doesn't have to get any other permits before it can start? Is that what the purpose of reading that CFR was?
No, okay. No. I'm giving you the authority that the license is effective, even though the Atomic Safety Licensing Board hearing hasn't been held. I think Mr. Mays' testimony stands. We can't withdraw water from the Madison or the Inukara until we get the water rights.
So your position then is that if the NRC staff gives an okay, you don't need any other permits to begin any other aspects of this operation. Is that what PowerTech's position is?
I am not prepared to address that in detail right now. I think we can commence what has been approved by the NRC. If other permits are needed to do an activity such as a water permit to withdraw water, we need to get those permits. To land apply, we would need to get that permit.
Just the record is clear.
Thank you, Mr. Mayne. We will take judicial notice of that. I noticed two additional A's, Ms. Anawati and Mr. Drager. Have any other A's come? Yes, sir. Thank you. Yeah.
And with that, we will continue cross-examination by other A interveners. I would ask you to come up to the podium, please, if you have any questions of Mr. Mays.
Thank you, Board, for letting us speak. Mark Boddicker from Mosa, South Dakota. Mark Boddicker from Mosa, South Dakota. Mr. Mays, on Tuesday, I recall your attorney talking to one of our B interveners, and he had indicated that there were other, what was the term he used? Other things you were planning to do with some of the water that you were planning to that you're applying rights for. Do you know what those other special things were going to be?
I believe you're maybe talking about the Madison Water Right, which is for groundwater restoration. It's for our plants, the satellite plant and the central processing plant. And it's also to supply water to for domestic and stock purposes.
Okay. Are you going to be utilizing any of that water for any other outside individuals?
No.
All right. I guess that's all I need to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. Anyone else?
My name is Susan Henderson. I have a few questions, if you would indulge me, please. Now, it's my understanding that you are going to be the person who designs and conducts the well field activity on the Dewey Burdock project. Is that correct?
I'm the vice president of engineering. My role is designing the project. I will probably have a role with operation of the well fields, but there will be staff to operate the well fields.
Okay, but are you going to supervise the design of where the well fields will be drilled?
Yes, we've presented a lot of that already in the application.
Right. Just for background. Now, I don't want to mess up my background here. So are you familiar with the leases, mineral leases, that you would be drilling these well fields?
To some degree, yes. That's not my primary area of responsibility, the leases.
I would like to show you this document, which comes from the mining claim report, but I think you did say that you supervised all of these applications, did you not?
Yes.
All right. May I approach with this document?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I wonder if I could pull this up and put it on the screen.
It's an exhibit.
Could we identify the document?
Well, we're trying to do that. I submitted this as a document that I was going to talk about in this period, so we already have to do that.
All right, could we identify the document, please?
All right, Ms. Henderson?
Yes.
Only one person can talk at a time. The reporter can't get these multiple conversations. So you need to identify the document so the parties can see it as well.
Okay, this is Appendix 2.2-A, dated December 2012.
Your exhibit number four.
It's my exhibit number four. There you go.
All right, thanks. Henderson number four.
Okay, now, can I get you to just put that for a second? And I think we're going to put it up on the screen so that you remember the stuff.
It looks correct, yeah. It's the only one that we have. It looks correct.
Would you like to see this minute so you can file it?
Ms. Henderson?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Am I doing this wrong?
Yes, you are, Ms. Henderson.
Okay.
Before you need to offer the exhibit into evidence.
Okay.
And you've identified it now as Henderson Exhibit Number 4.
Yes.
And then the parties have the ability to object.
Okay.
And then the chair will rule on the objection. If the chair determines that the exhibit is admitted, then it can go up on the screen.
Okay.
And then you can ask questions on it. Now, if you need to do a foundational exhibit as to whether the witness is aware of the exhibit and can identify it, that would go to his ability to talk to it, but you could ask that question that the court reporter will record the response and then offer it into evidence, and then we'll start the process.
Okay, so do I need to go show up to him again?
You show up to him again, ask him whether he can identify it, and ask him whether he's familiar with that exhibit.
All right, can you identify this, and are you familiar with this?
I can't really identify this. It's just one page here. I just know
it's not
you.
Your name. It came out of your mind equation. There's your number.
That's what I'm saying. There's just a little bit of information on there, so I don't. I'm willing to take your word that it came out of a large-scale mine application, but I can't really tell from this here.
Okay, now where do we go for Kim? Now that the witness
I'm assuming, Ms. Henderson, you're offering that as an exhibit.
I am.
Any objection?
Can I look at it?
Yes.
No objection.
Any objection, Ms. Best?
I just.
They need to look at it too.
I just want to make sure it's the one. You have the right one. No objection.
Ms. Best?
No objection.
Sorry that I don't have it. Okay, now when he's objecting, then I give it to you. Is that where we're at?
Just let's do it one step at a time.
Okay.
No objection.
All right, any other A interveners have objections? All right, and it is marked Henderson 4. Is Carla, is that what it's marked?
Well, I
don't think it has been marked.
Submitted that when I submitted my documents that I wanted to have. You know.
Okay, why don't you have the court reporter mark it?
But I need that back so I talk about it. And then I'll get that moving on.
All right.
Now,
Henderson Exhibit 4 will be received.
Okay, now, this is great. Okay, now, Mr. Mays, you see the BLM mineral interest in Custer County?
I'm having a hard time seeing that. Can I have, like, that page or something? It would be really good. I don't know what you got highlighted in the text.
That's quite a lot of BLM minerals. This is a. Can I make a tiny statement about this document?
No.
Or I could ask. This document was submitted to Fall River County as the filing for the application mineral interest for PowerTex mineral and. Mineral leases.
Objection, the intervener is testifying.
Well, I am going to testify about this.
Ms. Henderson, this is not your opportunity to testify.
Well, I'm not testifying. I'd be happy to ask you. All right, Mr. Mays, did you or did you not submit this to Fall River County on behalf of PowerTech with the large-scale mining permit application? For the purpose of defining the mineral interest in the Dewey Burdock project. And is that not your document?
You know, it's only one page, so it's a little hard to tell.
It's on both sides.
But it looks like what you're saying, yes.
Okay, good. Now, if you will look at the Custer side of it, where the BLM interests are, I took the liberty of adding these up. the total number of BLM acres. And would you say that that is 2,660 acres? Or would you like to borrow my calculator?
Is this the full list?
Sure.
I mean,
well, it's what you thought.
I can't really tell from this document. I would have to add a month individually. I don't have any way of confirming that's 2,000 acres.
Ms. Henderson,
yes.
You can't talk over the witness. The reporter will get angry at both of us.
Now, what I would like to do is provide him with a calculator so he can add his up. Can I do that?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh. And if you would, you could add up the ones on the Fall River County side also, please.
Can you give me Andrew, please?
I'm sorry.
There we go. Got it.
So you want to add up just the BLM acres is what you want to add up?
Let's start with that.
Can I have a piece of paper, please? Any paper is fine.
You know, I had these added up, but I didn't want to put it on the document because I didn't think I should put something extra onto it.
That was probably a good idea.
Okay.
Which owners are you wanting, surface or mineral?
Just the mineral, not the moment. Let's just add up the mineral ownership that says BLM.
Appendix 2.2-A that's been admitted by Ms. Henderson, it's only two pages, and there's three pages in Appendix 2.2-A we've just discovered. So
well, I think that you have all that in evidence at the moment, sir. The only document I want to discuss is this particular one.
It's not complete.
So you're saying your application is not complete?
Well, don't, Ms. Henderson, please don't argue. I'm going to permit Ms. Henderson to question. I believe everyone has the complete document, so if you want to ask questions about other parts of it, she just wants to question on these two pages, evidently, so I'm going to permit it.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, this is the mining permit application, so it is not currently in any of the documents filed, I don't believe, is it, Matt?
With this in this proceeding?
Right.
Correct.
Again, I think all of the parties have the document. I realize it's the mining side of it, but we have been talking about the mining side of it extensively, so I'm going to permit Ms. Henderson to question the witness first.
Thank you so much. Okay, Mr. Mays, how are you coming?
I got to restart.
Well, if that will help you, I'm showing that there are 2,660 BLM acres in Custer and 720 in Fall River County for a total of 3,380 BLM acres.
Okay, if that's the number, are you asking about the number?
No,
or
I
want
you to
confirm?
Add this up.
Ms. Henderson, only one at a time, please.
you want me to separate out Fall River and Custer County?
Sure, why don't you do that? Please.
Can we start with Fall River County?
Sure.
So on this page, here, I have 720 for Fall River.
Yep. Thank you.
Need the light on, Mr. Mays?
No. What number did you have for Custer?
I have 2,660 acres.
Let me try again. You say I got 2,220. Maybe I'm making a mistake.
Yes, you are. 2,660.
There
you go.
Okay.
Okay, now if you add those two figures together, the 720 and the 2660 for the two counties, that would give you your total for the project area.
What's on the other page then? And does that include other BLM minerals that are in the project area?
No, that's just a, that page is a description of some kind, as I recall. But this is what you filed.
This is not a conversation, folks. Ask questions. Answer the questions, please.
Well, can you add those two up?
Okay. From this page?
From the two pages.
I have 3,380.
Yes. Now, you testified yesterday that you have 10,580 acres in your project area. If you would divide the 3380 by the 10,580, you would get a percentage of the total project area that is BLM mineral leases.
I'm sorry, this is, calculator is a little different than the one I use.
Well, you're just dividing 3380.
I know, I'm just apologizing.
10,580.
Sorry.
Okay.
From this page, I get a percentage of 32%.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Now, you were testifying yesterday about the revenue that will stream from this into South Dakota and the counties. When you look at Custer County, would you not agree that a substantial portion of Custer County is BLM? Is that not right?
Do you mean the mineral ownership is by BLM?
Right.
Yes.
And the royalty that you will be paid to the Bureau of Land Management? Is that not correct?
I'm not aware of any royalties for that.
Well, you pay a fee every year for your 20-acre leases that you have within these BLM areas. Do you happen to know how many 20-acre leases that you have with the BLM?
That's, like I said, that's not my area of expertise. That's be for a land person. So I don't know the fees that we pay on those things.
Well, so you don't know what the fee is that you pay to the Bureau of Land Management for this? For these leases that you're going to use?
No, I don't know that off the top of my head, no.
Well, are you not aware that the when the BLM owns a mineral lease, how does that get collected?
Objection, asked and answered.
No, I'm just asking.
I believe it has been asked and answered in a simple sense.
All right. If you don't know in your company, who will know this?
Our land person, I testified about him earlier, Jim Bonner handles land issues.
Is he going to be testifying at this hearing?
No. Not. He's not he's on the witness list, but he's not one of the witnesses we expect right now.
No, this is an important thing because...
Objection.
What is your objection, Mr. May, exactly?
Well, is there a question?
And I'm going to sustain the objection, Ms. Henderson. It's not an opportunity to argue. If you have additional questions of the witness, please proceed.
Are you aware that you have agreements with other landowners that own their minerals for paying them royalties and whatever you have agreed to pay for their lease agreements? Are you aware of that?
I'm not sure the question. Are you asking if I'm aware we pay on leases?
Yes.
Yes.
And then when you design the drilling, you will have to keep track of whose mineral lease you are on. Is that not correct?
Yes.
And would you not agree then that some 32% of this project area will be BLM leases? We've testified to that. You still agree to that?
Yes, some percentage will be yes.
All right. So now then, how do you plan to differentiate the yellowcake processing uranium that is coming from the BLM leases versus the private leases? And how do you intend to keep track of that so you can pay them differently?
Just like we've kept track in mines before, where the permit boundary or, a boundary between two different landowners occurs as it crosses our well field area, we allocate pounds to each side of that boundary, and then we allocate production accordingly, just how it falls relative to that boundary. So we survey that boundary, and we know the amount of pounds that cross that area, and so we divide it up.
All right. Now you've got 32% owned by the BLM, and you've got the balance or some 58% or something owned by private leases. In your experience with this site, how much of the drilling that you're going to do is going to be on which source?
Are you asking how much drilling will be on BLM?
Yes.
As in terms of, honestly, I don't know that number. BLM, I believe there's, you know, most of the well fields are not on BLM. So I don't believe that that's unnecessarily a large number. I don't know how to quantify it. I've never done that.
Well, you do agree that you have 10,580 acres in your project area.
Yes.
Do you know how many square miles that is?
I've never converted it to square miles.
Well, it's pretty simple to do. You just
objection, argumentative.
You divide by
objection.
Ms. Henderson, I'm going to sustain the objection. The witness has said he's never done it.
Well, I guess I have to give up again.
Any other A interveners have questions for Mr. Mays?
Just for the purposes, of the record, this document is located within the Madison well application, which is exhibit number 20, pages 3, 4, and 5, I believe. So it is part of this record already.
Thank you, Mr. Higgy.
Is he talking about water rights exhibit number 20?
That's water rights exhibit 20?
Yes.
Thank you.
If I may interject, that there is in exhibit 20 of the water rights exhibit, there is a chart of mineral owners, and the first two pages are substantially similar, if not the same, but there is a third page that includes additional mineral ownership, and I wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Ms. Best. Mr. Cameron.
Yes, Marvin Cameron from Meade County. Mr. Mays, all these pipes that are used in wells, do they become hot in the process? Radiated hot?
Do you mean radioactive?
Yes.
There's a potential for internal radioactive contamination.
If I understand from your previous testimony, they may be plugged.
Are you talking about pipelines, or are you talking about the wells? Wells would be plugged.
I'm talking about the reclamation process. How many of these pipes, how much of this pipe, radiated pipe, may still be left in the ground?
None. The pipelines we pick up during reclamation, we dig them up and take them all out.
So in those holes that they come out of, what do you do with those?
Well, if it's pipeline trenches, we backfill them and compact them, and then we reseed them and make sure they revegetate properly. You may be talking about wells.
I'm talking about wells.
Wells. The wells are cut off below surface, and then they're plugged.
Don't those pipes remain hot in the bottom well?
They're not significantly radioactive.
They're not what?
They're not significantly radioactive.
But don't they remain in contact with the water that goes through this aquifer and therefore contaminating that? Isn't it a permanent contamination source?
No, the wells are fully plugged. So we remove the screen and we insert a pipe all the way to the bottom, pump cement, and we extract the pipe as we pump so that it's fully filled with cement. So they're basically sealed off permanently.
It's filled with cement, but in order to get into the aquifer, you punch this pipe into the aquifer to start the whole process.
I think I explained that.
So that pipe still remains there. How do you isolate it? I'm a little slow here. How do you isolate it, being it's already in the aquifer?
Are you talking about the casing? Or? We're
talking about whatever has been pumped and shut stuff into the aquifer.
Okay, when we cement, we remove that pipe while we're cementing. It's not left in the hole.
What happens to that pipe?
We use it on other wells. We keep using it.
Even though it's hot, you just throw it on a truck and transport it to the next site.
It can be decontaminated if necessary, but it's not significantly radioactive that we cannot use it in the site. So,
what do you consider significantly radioactive?
Where it causes the health risk.
Which is?
As I said, whether it causes a health risk. So, that those things are monitored by we call them health physicists, or radiation technicians.
Do the handlers wear suits? Because I understand radiation is dangerous. Do they wear suits, gloves?
At times they do, but for most of the operation in the well fields, that's not necessary.
I need a little clarification also. Once you oxidize this water, the input, doesn't it become kind of a guessing game what it might loosen up in the aquifer?
Can you help me with the question a little bit?
There's a lot of heavy metals that...
Mr. Main was objected. You have to let him...
I think this was covered extensively by Mr. Ellison in his cross-exam.
And I agree. I'm going to give Mr. Cameron a little latitude, but we really don't need to repeat questions and areas that have already been testified to and cross-examined, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you. Mr. Main, Hong Kong has been mentioned several times in this whole process, and it hasn't been stipulated that it is actually a part of China. And I would like to let the board inform the board that Hong Kong and where this other company is that's got shares in politics.
Objection, the intervener is testifying.
You can ask him if Hong Kong is part of China.
Do you believe that Hong Kong is part of China?
When do they... They're not currently part of China, right?
They're not?
I don't know.
The witness has answered he doesn't know. When you testify, you can put in any
evidence. Can you come up with that answer here before we leave these hearings?
Objection. The witness isn't required to do research for the intervener.
I'm going to sustain the objection.
Are you aware that second largest city of South Dakota has come out against this whole operation? Rapid City.
Objection. I don't think that's a fair characterization of the Rapid City Council's resolution.
Well, I'm going to let the question stand. If the witness can answer as the question was asked, he can.
I'm just aware of a resolution of great concern. I don't consider that opposition.
Oh, that's nice to know. That is the end of my questions now, panel. And if I don't get here again, I hope you all have a safe trip home. I hope you all have a very good Thanksgiving, remembering that
it's not a testimony. We appreciate
that
your thanks.
You all have it, and that justice is served.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Parkhurst, I believe you want to come up.
you, Mr. Chairman. Gina Parkhurst. I just got an email from Cheryl Rowe, a intervener, who had some questions. Is it appropriate for me to ask another A intervener's questions? She couldn't get away from her job.
You can certainly make them your questions. You can't stand in for Ms. Rowe, but if you want to ask those questions, you certainly can, Ms. Parkhurst.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Ms. Rowe?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I'll just ask mine. Good morning, Mr. Mays. Give me just a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Yesterday, I believe you stated that Wallace Mays is your father?
Yes.
Has he ever worked for PowerTech?
Yes.
Could you explain what capacity? Was he an employee or a board member or both?
He was chairman of the board as well as chief operating officer.
Is he still chairman of the board or chief operating officer?
No.
So he's no longer affiliated with PowerTech in terms of employment or the board?
No.
Do you know if he currently owns any shares of PowerTech stock?
I'm going to object on the grounds of relevancy.
I think he can answer yes or no to that question, Mr. Mays.
I don't know.
Mr. Mays, do you personally own any shares of PowerTech stock?
No.
Have you ever owned any shares of PowerTech stock?
Yes.
Are you able to tell me how many shares you owned?
Objection. This is private information, proprietary. Relevancy. Checked on the ground of relevancy.
I agree, Ms. Parkhurst. He's testified he doesn't at this time, and he's generally testified that he has in the past. I think that's sufficient.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, wouldn't it be important as to the interest of the witness as well as for the information of this board if this witness no longer owns PowerTech stock, even if the numbers are not admissible, certainly the why he no longer owns such stock would be
interesting. I think that's completely irrelevant.
I agree. And Ms. Parkhurst didn't ask the question.
Mr. Mays, may I ask why you no longer own shares of PowerTech stock?
Objection. That is irrelevant to this proceeding.
I agree. Sustained.
Switching topics, in the video shown at the beginning of your testimony yesterday, I noticed a frame that indicated different levels of regulation involving ISL uranium mines. And I can't remember the title of the slide, but at the bottom, there was a line about state and health agencies involved in regulating ISL uranium mines. And your resume shows that, or first, do you remember that slide or that frame?
Yes.
Okay. And I believe your resume shows that you have worked at ISL uranium mines in various states, correct?
Yes.
So my question is, in thinking about the other states where you have worked at ISL uranium mines, could you please broadly compare state regulation and health regulation in those states with similar regulation in South Dakota? Or in other words, would you say that the other states have more or less regulations than South Dakota in general?
Objection. That's a overly broad and vague and indefinite question to ask the witness to compare the other jurisdictions' laws to South Dakota.
Well, I'm going to allow these
these interveners some flexibility in their questions. If Mr. Mays has trouble answering it because it's ambiguous or overly broad, I think he can indicate that. But I'm going to permit him to answer. The various jurisdictions have been talked about an awful lot the last couple of days. So go ahead, Mr. Mays.
They're very similar.
In thinking about those other states in which you have worked at ISA uranium mines, were any of those mines in areas that had a lot of tourism or tourist attractions?
Yes.
Do you consider that the ISR uranium mine at Smith Highlands Ranch is a good example of compliance with regulations?
I'm going to object. That's irrelevant. PowerTech has no ownership interest or participation in that facility, and it's been, I think, at least 10 years since the witnesses was employed there.
And I'm going to permit the question. I think she's asking his opinion as to whether or not that's a good example. So you can answer, Ms. Mays, if you can.
I would say, for the most part, it is a good example. I think they have very low instances over their entire decades of operation of problems or anything negative about their site. I think that they could probably do better. Based on some of the recent things such as the bond increase that was mentioned. But I do think that they do a good job of compliance. And remember, this is for many decades. So they have very few, I mean, I know it's a very few, I'm not sure how many, but it's very few, any instances that I know of where it's resulted in like a violation or something like that over all these years. So I think it is a good industry and a good example, but there's always room for improvement.
Switching topics, could you please explain the definition of an excursion according to the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
You know, this is written down. I could read from it if that's possible. They have a written definition, and I think it'd be great to read from if I can use some materials.
Would you like him to do that, Ms. Parker?
Yes.
I'm handing the witness what is marked as our Exhibit 138, which is the Environmental Impact Statement for Moore Ranch ISR Project. This would have been disclosed to all parties.
You're just giving it to the witness so he can read the definition.
Yes.
All right.
And particularly, the witness will be reading, I believe, from page D is in Baker 75.
NRC does not define an excursion as contamination that moves into a USDW. An excursion is defined as an event where a monitoring well in overlying, underlying, or perimeter well ring detects an increase in specific water quality indicators, usually chloride, alkalinity, and conductivity, which may signal that fluids are moving out from the well field. These specific water quality parameters are used because they are present in high concentrations in the ISR production fluids and are conservative in the sense that they move at roughly the same rate as the groundwater flow and are not significantly attenuated by absorption or reduced by other factors. Therefore, they serve as early indicators of imbalance in the wellfield flow system to notify operators to take appropriate actions.
Thank you. I'm not scientifically trained. Could you please explain what kind of an indicator is used? Is it electronic? Is it mechanical?
As I said, those indicators that I just told you in that definition are the same ones for our project, chloride, alkalinity, and conductivity. More so than that, we also look at water levels in all of our monitoring wells. That's an immediate indication of the cone of depression, which I don't believe we mentioned, but it's that we're always inward pulling to the well field that the system is in balance like it should be.
If I may ask a clarifying question, is there a room with a computer screen that shows that there could be a problem? Or is there a light that lights up? Or I'm not sure how the operators would become aware of an excursion.
Excursion, there's sampling that occurs twice per month. So it is during those events that you would detect an excursion. But as far as balancing of a well field, and that sample data that's collected in the field, go to the well to collect the sample. In the field, we balance the well field flow rates on a daily basis. And that's how it's done. And we have, to help you out on the computer part, those flow rates of the pipelines and wells can be observed from the operator in the central processing plant, say, or the satellite plant at any time.
So I'm understanding that you're saying that there's actually two different ways that this monitoring of excursions occurs. It's both the twice a month sample of water in various wells. Correct?
Yes.
And then the second way is through this computer system that actually shows the flow rates and where the water is moving?
Flow monitoring, yes. Flow monitoring
on the computer?
Yes, of the flow rates of the wells.
Okay. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Parkhurst. Ms. Rowe, I know you have some questions.
Michelle
Rowe.
Hi.
Hello.
Could you tell me how many boreholes, test holes, there are in the area already?
Over 4,000.
Okay. And are those boreholes or test holes, are they cased?
No, when we mean boreholes, those are geophysical exploration holes that they're not cased. Therefore, you know, running a logging tool and measuring a logging tool, a geophysical logging tool, measuring the amount of, basically measuring the ore body, and those are plugged back after that work is done.
So all of the test holes and bore holes are closed?
Yes.
Plugged?
All except for, we pointed, there is an area known as the alkali area, where we have a leaky bore hole suspected.
What are they plugged with?
It's a bentonite slurry. It can be cement if it's flowing well.
So when you talk about casing the holes for the project, they will be cased for both the injection and the extraction. Those will be cased?
Yes. we refer to those as wells. Just
wells.
That's
okay.
Kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Wells and boreholes, we like to use those two words.
Okay. So when the wells are cased, they're cased with cement?
Yes.
And how thick is that cement?
You're talking about the difference between the outside borehole that and the casing itself?
Yeah.
It's something like 2 inches.
Okay, so I guess my question would be how can I say this? Will that casing hold up with the pressure of the water, or will the solution break down that cement?
No, and specifically our requirements require a sulfate resistant cement. That wasn't on the slide that we showed earlier. So the cement doesn't have the opportunity to degrade. This is something that's commonly used in the Black Hills.
So it'll dissolve uranium and the ore body, but it won't dissolve the casing.
It dissolves. What we dissolve is, we don't dissolve the rock. Uranium is, it's in between the grains of the rock. It's like a coating on those grains, and so we dissolve that, and this uses oxygen and carbon dioxide. It doesn't affect the casing integrity either. So.
When you talk about the economic recovery of the uranium, what is the percent of uranium that is not recovered, that's left over when it's no longer, when it's not economic? What percent do you not recover that's not economic?
Well, our goal is to get as much of it as we can. That's
okay.
What you do in production. You want to recover as much as you can. For our purposes of our economic assessments, we say we use 75% recovery, meaning that we recover 75% and 25% we do not recover.
So 25% would remain in the waste solution, in the waste waters?
25% of the native uranium may not be mined.
So it'll stay. The 25% you're saying would be in the ground. So you're saying you're going to recover the 100% out of your solution, your pregnant solution. You're going to recover 100% of the uranium out of that solution?
Of the solutions, essentially, yes. You get everything out of the solutions and the groundwater, because we do groundwater restoration. I'm talking about the 25% that's left is the solid uranium that we did not dissolve.
If there's uranium still down there, but those solutions are there within that area, will they continue to break down?
No, because when we stop restoration, a key component is making sure that we're no longer injecting any oxygen. Plus, those groundwaters are known to be barren of oxygen, and so it essentially stops any reactions once we've completed groundwater restoration.
In the process, when you go from the satellite to the processing plant, how is the solution moved from the satellite process to the processing plant? Is that by truck?
We transport resin, is what we transport in a truck.
In a truck?
Yeah.
Can I ask why they don't place the processing plant closer to the satellite facility and just use pipes instead of using a truck?
The reason is the distance. So near our central processing plant, we have well fields that are mined in the same building as the central processing plant. There's ion exchange equipment in the central processing plant. A satellite plant just has ion exchange equipment. So the central processing plant includes the dryer, elution systems, and elution columns for processing resin. There's not a need to build another plant once you have one. So you just haul resin over to one plant.
How many different areas are there where waste is found? In that when you're putting the solution through the ionized beads, when you're connecting them to that, is there waste from that process? Because you're running it through that container and it's connecting to those beads. Is there a waste product from that particular process?
No, I'm not sure if I'm following exactly your question, but when we're loading resin, the water circulates through resin. You know, the pregnant solution or the production solution, it circulates through the resin. Uranium is loaded on there. We take that resin out. There's really not a byproduct that time. I think if I'm wasting
it. Okay, and then that is loaded into the truck.
That's loaded in the truck.
And then it's hauled to the processing facility.
Yes.
And it goes through the deionizing. So that's where, when you remove the uranium from those ionic beads, that's where the waste comes in.
There's some waste there. That's, we use that brine solution. We call it eluent. I know that's kind of a hard word. But it's a sodium chloride solution. That's what we use to, we call it stripping the uranium off of the resin. And that is some of the waste that we generate.
And
wastewater.
What is within that waste? Then all the heavy metals and some uranium, and what would be within that waste?
Well, it's it has the potential for some radionuclides in it, which we'd have to remove. But for the most part, it's salty water. It's salty water. I mean, so we can reuse that for the next solution, and so we don't want to waste salt. Salt is actually.
I guess in my head I can't quite get this when you're pulling up the uranium underground. You're also pulling up the selenium and the other elements. So that's within that solution, correct?
There is potential for things to be in the eluent.
Okay. So then, when you get to when you're loading those ionic beads, those other elements, where do they go? They just remain in that. Water? I'm not understanding what happens with all the other elements that are within the solution. At what point do they come out?
You're talking about the well-filled solutions that we circulate? Or are you talking about this element that I mentioned?
The pregnant solution that you're now going to pull the uranium from.
So
it's also going to contain other elements, correct?
So we're talking about the well fields, right? The well fields that we're circulating.
Right.
And it goes through the ion exchange resin.
Okay, does that ion exchange, what does that do with
it? It removes a lot of things.
Okay,
yes.
When it removes a lot of things, where do they go?
They go with the resin.
So they're going to go into the truck and over to the processing
plant. And then, yes.
So they go to the processing plant.
Yes.
Deionized, so you're getting the beads removed so they can go back to the ion.
The loading.
Yes.
I'm saying.
Okay, so then. So after you remove the beads, you're separating out the uranium. All the other elements that have been stirred up along with the uranium. Where do they now, where do you pull those out, and what do you do with them?
We treat those. Like I said before, we treat that for radionuclides.
Okay, so how much water are we talking about?
That's a, you know, to give you an idea, that's there's like a 12,000 gallon tank of brine used about once a day in a million pound per year operation.
Okay, so when you remove the elements from that, and I think that you said that you would use like just a reverse osmosis, is that correct?
That's for groundwater restoration.
Oh, okay. So what process would you use to remove those elements from that?
The same ones that I mentioned before. Ion exchange and radium settling.
So the ion exchange removes the uranium?
Yes, but it can remove other things too. So one of the processes may be an additional treatment with ion exchange, because we have to meet the same limits for that fluid as we do with anything else, such as the bleed.
And you have to, the uranium really has to be pretty pure for you to make, you make good money if the uranium is really pure, correct? I mean, it makes a difference.
But you avoid a penalty. If you have some contaminants, you can incur a penalty. So
are there like solid wastes with that process? Or are we talking only water waste? With the whole process, are there solids also pulled and removed?
As part of our, I mean, there is solid waste generated from our project. It's very minimal. As far as with the wastewater, the only solid waste that I can think of that's substantial is you know, would we settle the radium out with barium chloride in the bottom of the radium settling pond? So those are designed so that it'll hold the whole volume over the life of the project. When we decommission the project and decommission the ponds, we have to ship that off to a licensed Levany 2 facility.
A licensed what?
A Levany 2 facility, which is that's a byproduct material disposal facility. Like we mentioned before, Energy Solutions would be one of these in Utah. White Mesa Mill in Blanding, Utah is another one that's used.
Every project's finished, and you guys are long gone. Is there anything in place for monitoring of the area, say 75 years from now?
There wouldn't be, as far as I know, a requirement to monitor 75 years from now, because before we can stop monitoring, we have to demonstrate that we've completed restoration. We have to demonstrate after that. I mean, that demonstration is part of what we call stability, where we look at is it stable? I mean, are things going to change? And so then we have to get approval that it's okay to release it, and then that would achieve NRC approval. Where it could potentially not be monitored, but then we also have to submit to DNR for release from their post-closure monitoring requirements. So we have to get, before we can stop monitoring, it basically has to be proven that it's not migrating, that it's meets the requirements.
Okay, and the industries, the industry really likes to have those deep injection well rather than the irrigated ponds, correct? As a waste disposal.
Yes.
So can those deep injection wells somehow be monitored? Or is that why they possibly like...
No objection.
I think that's kind of argumentative. If you can answer the question, the first question that's asked, Mr. Mason.
Which one was the first question?
So, is the deep injection wells are the preferred method for the industry?
Yes.
Can those deep injection wells be monitored?
When we have submitted our applications to EPA for the deep well, it must be proven that there is no potential to contaminate an underground source of drinking water. So, for example, the Madison. So we have to demonstrate that confinement is there already so that we cannot contaminate a potential underground source of drinking water. Furthermore, additional to that, the zones that we inject to they must exceed 10,000 parts per million total dissolved solids. So that's basically why we have to prove this before we can get a permit. So they can require monitoring if they desire, if they think it's necessary.
So have you proved that you can do that?
I believe we have, but we have not received the permit yet.
And that would be the permit from the EPA?
Yes.
So the deep injection wells, would they also be cased?
There is extensive casing with deep disposal wells. In fact, they're much different than our mining wells in some regards. So it's expected to be dual casing for those wells, but internal to that, we would inject through a tubing, and between the innermost casing and the tubing, we monitor the annulus pressure continuously. So you have a pressure monitor on the well. So if there is ever a leak in the casing or the tubing, it's immediately discovered and the well is shut down immediately. So you can't have a leak into any USDW if a casing failure did occur or a tubing failure occurred.
So after you're finished with the project, those wells, deep injection wells, also get plugged?
Yes, they do.
And they're plugged with what? The same?
Cement.
And how long does cement last until it actually just breaks down?
In this case, it lasts, I'm not sure how long it lasts, but a very long time.
100, 200 years?
I would expect that lasts, essentially forever. So, you're cementing the entire, 3,000 feet or so of casing.
I guess I've never known cement to last forever.
Well, if there's no reaction occurring, which there's not a reaction occurring in this case, so there's nothing to degrade it. So if it were to degrade it, it would have to degrade, thousands of feet of cement.
Wouldn't it degrade from the outside in?
Well, there's cement on the outside. There's casing on the outside as well. So I'm not sure how long the final life is, but it'd be a very, very long time.
And what is the half-life of uranium?
I said that earlier, 4.5 billion years.
Okay. Thank you.
How many, Ms. Lees, how many other interveners intend to ask questions? Mr. Knudsen? And Ms. Anawadi?
Come back.
And, okay. And I think we'll take a 10-minute break. We're not going to break for lunch. We'll take a 10-minute break. I believe you're ready to cross-examine.
Yes, thank you. And you have to bear with me. I have notes all over the place. Good afternoon, Mr. Mays.
Good afternoon.
Have you studied the Inyankara report 2686-2 that's on the DENR? The application and all the things that are on the website.
You're talking about the engineer.
Yes.
Recommendation.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. In that, it stated that Powertech expects to request a permit amendment for an extension of the 5-year construction period pursuant to SDL 46-2-A-8. I just wanted to understand why you would need an extension of the 5-year construction period.
The life of our project, just for construction, you remember we have a phased development of our operation. There's 14 well fields. So it takes over 8 years to build all those well fields.
I see. That makes sense. All right. In that same report, it stated that recharge is an average annual, regarding to recharge, that an average annual recharge has not been quantified for the Inyankara. Are you aware of that?
No.
And then it says that no application may be approved if it is probable that quantity withdrawn annually exceeds annual recharge. Are you familiar with that?
That sounds like the rules and regulations to me.
My question is, and it did state in there about that it hasn't been quantified. If it hasn't been quantified, I was needing to understand how one could evaluate this in terms of predictions.
My understanding is there is an evaluation of recharge in the engineer's reports. So are you talking about Madison or Inyankara? I thought you were talking about
Inyankara.
Inyankara. I'm pretty sure that there's a recharge basin, recharge area that's talked about in the report. So,
I took the quote from the report that it said that an average annual recharge has not been quantified for the Inyankara.
I don't know if they necessarily had it quantified in terms of flow rate. They might have quantified it in other ways. Flow rate.
Okay.
So I don't remember the details that well, but I know that there's a recharge area that's in the report, and that was part of the estimation that was done.
I also read in that report, in the Inyankara report, engineer's report, that the Inyankara withdrawal is stated to be 10,700 acre feet a year, and the precipitation recharge was listed as 11,600 acre feet a year. Would you consider those numbers to be fairly close in your line of work? I mean, to me as a citizen, I'm looking at this. Is that close, those two numbers?
Close to
each other. In other words, 10,700 is what the withdrawal would be. The precipitation recharge would be 11,600. So
I think you would be better asking hydrologists
on
precipitation and things like that. I'm not really certain about those things.
Ms. Leeds?
Yes.
You have to let him finish his answer before you start talking.
Switching to the Madison report now. On page 10 of that report, something called the, correct me if I'm saying this wrong, Tice equation?
Tice.
And it's stated that after 20 20 years at 550 gallons per minute that it would be expected to go down 35 feet. Is that correct?
In what location are you talking about? Is that at the wellbore?
I can't answer that. I just read that in there, and I just wondered about the 35 feet.
And I think that's the wellbore itself, right near the wellbore. So,
okay. So that's at the wellbore.
I don't know. I don't know those numbers that precisely.
Is that another hydrologist question?
You'd be better asking a hydrologist, absolutely.
Is it true that in this ISL process that the low pH and oxidation mechanisms, heavy metals, and hazardous elements are mobilized from the ore and could contaminate the groundwater? Is that a possibility?
I don't understand that we will have low pH solutions. I think that our pH range will be from slightly acidic to a little more so alkaline. But pretty close to neutral.
Close to neutral.
Yes.
Is it possible for elements to be, is it actually possible for them to migrate out of the ore body into the surrounding aquifers that would feed the local water supply?
No.
No. There's been a lot discussed about, not a lot, but some things talked about this groundwater sweep. And in reading that applications, I just wanted to get some things clarified here, so that's what I'm going to be asking about. Did I hear you say yesterday that you are not going to, or you are going to do groundwater sweep? Which of those is it?
We provided two options. Okay, so our intended method for groundwater restoration, and this was NRC approved, those methods, is just to circulate and use an RO. Okay, but we provided, if necessary, because poor groundwater sweep has been done at other uranium mines, we will. Basically, groundwater sweep means you use less injection so that you pull more on the formation, pull inward stronger. We had that as a possible option. There is more water consumption with that option. And when we made our request for water for the Indian Kara, we included that more consumptive use in that 170 GPM.
Why I'm trying to understand this, because on the it's hard up at this podium when you don't have a table to put things on. In the interrogatory answers on page 11 from, it says Clean Water Alliance's first set of interrogatories and requests for production of documents to DENR. It has it in bold on page 11, number 6. It says, the DENR staff note that the applicant is essentially eliminating the groundwater sweep phase and instead using groundwater treatment immediately. The staff find this strategy acceptable. And so, do you agree with that?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, that agrees with our philosophy.
Okay.
Understand you right.
Okay, so then really we don't need to talk much about groundwater sweep. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Does not doing groundwater sweep, does that disrupt the RO membranes more than if you had done groundwater sweep?
No.
Regarding the filters to be used, these membranes, have you identified as of yet a brand or manufacturer for these filters, the membranes?
Per RO units?
Yes.
We know of many kinds. FilmTech, there's a lot of kinds. And
yeah.
No, we have not specified them at this time.
Would there be a range of quality of those kinds of things out in the market?
Well, there's a huge range of applications and different brands. There's quite a few manufacturers. So, they can be specific for higher concentrations of salt or lower concentrations of salt, for example.
Could we as citizens be assured that we will be getting the Cadillac version instead of the Chevy?
Well, they all have standards. So when you buy a piece of equipment, it has to meet a set of standards. So
does the NRC, do they have standards for that?
They don't have standards for RO membranes, no.
So would you know what the general lifespan of such a membrane would be?
It varies between the type of membrane that you use. It can be a couple years. And they're typically something that's considered a consumable that you replace, but it does last a little while. Once their performance starts decreasing, you replace them. And
now, do you have a system, a computer, some kind of system that reads into the control house or whatever that would tell you when these membranes need to be replaced, or is that by observation?
No, it can be automated. It's not necessary that it be automated, but basically you look at differential pressure across the membranes, and when it starts increasing a little bit, then to change them out.
And are you the person that would be in charge of selecting those and obtaining that for this project?
I would expect to be, yes.
And have you done that same task on your previous jobs?
To some degree, yes. Yes.
Switching topic here, pertaining to potential flooding of the project area, have you considered this problem?
Yes.
And in your consideration of it, what kind of model or projection did you use in terms of, say, inches of rain that one might get that you would be prepared for?
Well, it's pretty extensive amount of work done on this, so it's kind of hard for me to explain all of those things. But in general, all the items are located outside of the floodplain. Your structures, your buildings. There was a model used that used a 100-year flood event in a general sense, but a lot of the diversion structures and such use a 6-hour maximum PMP. I'm not a person that does those things, but there's extensive work on this. You can probably ask when Jack Fritz gets up if you want to ask him some of those questions.
What is his name?
Jack Fritz, WIC.
Do you know the inches that were used for that 100-year?
I don't know, but I think the 6-hour PMP, which is probable maximum precipitation event, is something like 22 inches in 6 hours, but I'm not. This is not my specialty. I don't know these things.
And were you in the room to hear the testimony about the flood a few days ago that they had down there?
Yes.
So you know they got 9 inches within a 24-hour period.
That would be less than our 6-hour PMP.
Regarding restoration bleed, again, could you just explain, and I apologize if you explained this before, I've been taking as many notes as I can here, but it says it will be between 1 and 17%. Is that correct?
No, that's for restoration. We were talking about it's on, 500 GPM is the flow rate of restoration. So the 1 to 17% of the 500 GPM, 70% is that groundwater sweep we were talking about earlier.
Yesterday, you mentioned pond operators in your testimony. Do you remember that?
Pond operators?
Yeah. I guess men or women that operate or, like, supervise the ponds.
I probably call them operators.
What kind of expertise or what kind of person does that job?
Oversight of ponds are usually done by a technical person, a health and safety technician that's trained in those things. So operators would do the monitoring. They would be trained to do the monitoring. So the monitoring of those things is fairly straightforward. So, you're checking for leak detection, checking the leak detection, sumps and things like that, hazing if necessary, those kind of things. So.
Would you expect that type of job description? Now, would that person come from our area here, or is that something that Power Tech would bring in from somewhere else?
Oh, I would rarely expect we could find qualified persons in this area. Readily. Sorry, I got to drink more.
When we looked at your resume yesterday that was gone over, we saw that you had been a plant operator, a production engineer, a restoration engineer, etc. Those kinds of positions, are they, when you are that, are you the only one of those in that job description, or is it a team of those kinds of people usually?
There's a team. Anything we do, it's a team. My position sometimes is the only one if I'm a superintendent, say. But, this is a team effort always. So we expect to have a team of technical staff at our project that will work on various facets. I mean, on also all manner of things. So,
regarding that team, would you be the boss of that team then, or the head of it, or is it people that have equal status as yourself?
We have a position called a facility manager. He would be essentially the boss of the site. So I'm not necessarily the facility manager.
And that person would answer to you?
The way the organization chart right now, I believe that person would answer to the chief operating officer.
The chief, that's the CEO. And is it true on that diagram that that person isn't there yet?
That's correct.
Okay. We looked at your education, and do you have any advanced degrees, such as a master's degree or a master's plus 40 or a PhD or anything?
No.
Have you done any research or had any publications?
No.
Then referring to PowerTech's answers to the Clean Water Alliance interrogatories, page 26, question 30, I guess it's paragraph 3. There is a gentleman mentioned, says isolation of aquifers is demonstrated by USGS research by Raymond Johnson. Have you personally worked with Mr. Johnson at all on anything with this project?
Mr. Johnson sampled our project site, so we did assist him on that.
So you have that?
Yes.
Just as a professional, do you study water issues in general, such as aquifers, water scarcity, contamination, on the national level, more than just our own job proposition here?
I'm a chemical engineer, not a hydrologist.
Okay. I had to cross off some. Those of us that are here as citizens, if we learned of some kind of problem, any kind of problem pertaining to this project are going, who would a citizen contact, or who is the person that is in charge for that we could contact? Who do we call?
At the mine site?
Yeah.
Call the facility manager.
And will that be a publicly, will that information be available to the public so it's easy to find out what that number is?
Yes.
And did I understand that earlier today you basically said you don't really know anything about Azaria, is that correct?
I don't know much about Azaria. It's a fairly recent thing that's happened. So.
Is anybody going to testify that would know about the financial things pertaining to that? Mm. The financial assets of your company?
I'm not aware of anyone testifying on that.
It was stated in a quote of Mr. Hollenbeck in the paper, I think it was Mr. Hollenbeck, either Mr. Hollenbeck or Mr. Clement, in yesterday's Rapid City Journal, that about filing an amendment to the NRC application. Are you aware of that?
No.
Is there a limit to your knowledge, since you've worked on these applications, is there a limit on how often a company can file amendments with the NRC?
I would think the limit would be, you know, the ability of the staff to process an application, or amendments, I should say. Which is a pretty real limit.
Is this a common thing? In other words, your other projects you worked on, did they file amendments with the NRC?
I believe they have, yes.
Is the carbon dioxide and oxygen mixture, is that, would that be characterized as an acidic thing?
As I stated earlier, you know, our pH is expected to be around neutral, from slightly acidic to slightly more alkaline.
And in our readings and testimonies here, we've heard the word recirculate and re-inject. Are they basically analogous? I'm just trying to understand.
Well, they're somewhat analogous, yes.
They're
somewhat analogous, yes.
Would you characterize the Indian Car as a quote-unquote lower-level aquifer? Lower level pertaining, that would be pertaining to quality, not quantity.
Well, my understanding that the Indicare in our area is not drinking water quality.
Do you know any communities or families or individuals, though, that do use the Indicare for drinking water?
Definitely.
I'm sorry?
I said definitely.
So, I'm not understanding your first answer as compared to the second answer. If people do drink it and use it, then...
They're not necessarily drinking water, quality water.
But if they got... Would they be able to drink it if they got...
They can,
for lack of a better word, something like Culligan or some kind of treatment, would they be able to drink it then?
They're drinking it now, and it's not drinking water quality.
You referred to, quote-unquote, our pump tests, and then you clarified that you were talking about tube tests. Were you personally involved in those? Pump tests?
A little bit, yes, a little bit.
What entity, and again, I know you're not a hydrologist, what entity or person or company would have been, maybe, I guess you'd call it subcontracted or in charge of doing that, those pump tests?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the pump tests have been testified to extensively earlier today.
I agree, and I'm going to sustain
that. I might have missed that. I apologize. Have you been involved from the very, very beginning with all these applications, the DS, EIS, and all the applications pertaining to this project?
The DS. EIS is not an application.
Well,
that's an NRC document.
The document.
Just for clarification. And this process began before I was hired.
You are familiar with the DS EIS, though?
Yes.
how does the NRC obtain that data that they get to come up with that document?
One of the sources is our application that we submit to them, but they also collect their own information.
To your knowledge, has the BLM expressed any concerns related to water quality, land use, or cumulative effects pertaining to this project?
I'm not aware of such a thing.
You have read the DSEIS?
Yes.
Would it surprise you to learn that on pages 1 to 16 in the DSEIS, it says that they express concerns?
Somewhat, yes.
Are there any wetlands within the project area?
Yes.
Are there any jurisdictional waters that are affected in that area?
I believe the answer is no. It's not fully up to speed on jurisdictional. Pretty sure that the answer is no.
I believe in PowerTech 2009B Appendix 3.5-H that it mentions that there are four jurisdictional waters in there. You're not aware of that?
You said, are we going to affect them?
I'm sorry?
I said that there was jurisdictional wetlands, but you said that we're going to affect them. And I said I'm not aware that we are going to affect them. I don't believe we are.
Okay. Are you aware of any concern by the Forest Service pertaining to this project?
No.
Has the USGS staff expressed any concern to your knowledge about contaminated groundwater that may travel from the project area into Beaver Creek within the project area and the Cheyenne River south of the project area near ground or surface water? Are you, to make it simple, are you aware of the USGS formally acknowledging any concerns?
I'm not aware of that.
Would you agree that this project is placed in a semi-arid region?
I think that's a good description.
Would you acknowledge that evaporation within the operations, such as ponds, etc., would result in significantly greater quantities of water lost? I guess I'm asking you, have you considered evaporation as a quantifiable and serious loss of water pertaining to all the water outlay? That would be your water, groundwater, the pivots and the ponds and
the land application process itself involves evaporation. So, I mean, that's part of where why it's an effective method of groundwater disposal. So, it's quite a complex model that's used for that, and that facilitates us using the land application areas for wastewater disposal.
Is it true that 52.6 million gallons of water will be used for just construction alone?
I I can't remember numbers like that, how much water is used for construction.
Still on the DSEIS, which you said a few times I've read, can you explain how the NRC staff predicts cumulative impacts to surface waters and wetlands will be moderate to large, but then a few pages later in the same section says that the Dewey Burdock project will have a small incremental impact on surface waters and wetlands? Are you aware of that contradiction?
I'm not. It's quite a few words in that section, so I'm not sure if that's portrayed correctly or not. I don't remember exactly, so it's a little hard for me to answer your question.
Would you say that the irrigation pivots, their job is to dispose of hazardous waste?
No.
How do you define hazardous waste then?
It has to have hazardous materials within it.
Would this substance that's pivoted out, would it have selenium in it?
The concentrations of selenium would have to be low, below limits that I talked about earlier, established on baseline within the soils and vegetation. I mean, those changes in soil and vegetation would not have to be significant from baseline and in the increasing trends. So there is a possibility that very low concentrations of selenium could be in the soil, but we're monitoring all the time for the bioaccumulation, and we have limits of what can be there that are basically set at baseline. So we can't change things from baseline, but I do not believe that selenium is a hazardous element. And this would be well below drinking water standards. So,
if that limit were superseded, what would be the mechanism or plan, or how do you do something about that?
This corrective action includes treatment. There's other things that can be done. Corrective action can change the operation, so change the pivot areas. There's several other things too. So like phyto remediation is included in there.
To your knowledge, with your company, because there's a lot of calculations that have to be made about a lot of these things, such as the upper control limit calculations, does your company also hire professional statisticians to assist you in doing these tasks?
We use statistics. We don't hire a statistician for that. The technical people have to be trained to use statistics in whatever area they're in, such as in groundwater data and things like that. There's statistics involved.
I don't see how we're going to get the rest of the A's done within a reasonable period of time. I don't want to have to rush people, and I know most of us have long drives ahead of us, so unless the board tells me otherwise, I would like to adjourn until December 9th. We will be back in Rapid City. Yes, Mr. Knutson.
Yeah, Rob Knutson here. As far as my comments are concerned, I think I could defer that to the hydrologist. Actually, better not to take up any more time anyway. So, thanks.
All right, thank you, Mr. Knutson. What we will do, I think we're going to, we may not be in this exact same room, but as I understand it, we will be at the Ramkota on December 9th. We will start at 8:30 a.m. And we, at that time, we will continue with the A participant cross-examination. Then we will have any questions the board may have, and as a board, we usually have some questions of our own. And then Mr. Main will be given an opportunity for redirect and an additional cross on the redirect testimony. So bring another pitcher of tea, Mr. Main. Yes, and everybody's aware of the briefing schedule for those. I would remind everybody the board is off limits. We cannot discuss this with anybody, so please don't try and discuss anything with us. Any other points, Ms. Main?
The week of December 9, we have one witness who's I had intended on calling as the first witness, but I know we'll finish up the cross on Mr. Mays, and then I can do redirect. That witness is only available Monday and Tuesday of that week. And so what I was wondering is if we get started on him and he has to go, if I can take another witness out of place. I don't think the rest of my witnesses would fill the week, but you know, I don't know. And the witness who's only available Monday and Tuesday is Doyle Fritz. He's the Madison Aquifer and the social and economic impact analysis.
Well, maybe we should take him out of order, take him first thing Monday, so we can have 2 days for him and then bring Mr. Mays back.
And whatever works next for your people, it's fine.
Yeah, that, you know, that may work. Just, I wanted to be let everybody know if we can be flexible. I think we could be done with Mr. Fritz in 2 days, and then maybe pick back up with John. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll kind of play that by ear.
Okay.
I'm assuming all of the A's want to be here anyway, whether they are going to start the cross, but we'll try and have some flexibility on that.
Yeah. Are you talking about maybe taking him right away Monday morning?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
And then that would give us 2 full days just to
for him.
You need it, 2 full days, and then we could put Mr. Mays back on.
To finish cross and do that. Yeah, that may work. Thank you.
Just one question. I just want to make sure I got the right Fritz, because there are 2 Fritzes. Jack Doyle. It's Doyle Fritz.
It's Doyle Fritz, yes.
Thank you, everyone. Ms. Bess.
If I may, the briefs to be filed, I want to make sure that they do go to each member of the board.
Yes. Each member of the board needs the briefs, please. And board counsel.
And board counsel.
Do we send all copies of the board members to the DNR office and then distribute, or do we have addresses? I don't have addresses for board members.
I
Would you like the chief engineer's office to send out a notice with the briefing questions and the addresses, or?
Everybody has the briefing questions, I believe, on it. And to facilitate things on it, how about as board counsel send the board's briefs to me and then I'll forward? And so anybody that wants to submit briefs, submit them to me in the Attorney General's office, 1302.
It's on the certificate
of service. It's on the certificate of service,
thank you. So this would go to the same certificate of service that the A parties have been using previously?
Correct. And that would be for me as board counsel.
Okay. We send every copy to you, Jeff?
Yes. I mean, that way it would allow me to send them out. I mean, I repackage them and fire them out.
I believe you have a question.
No, he's not a party to the proceeding. He's not a party to the proceeding. But
I was listed as a B. My name is Paiute Harris. I was listed as a B. Subsequently, I was removed along with all the other B presenters. On December 9th, seeing as this will be a new topic and will be past the water topic, just for clarification, will all of the B presenters be sidelined like they were this time?
No, the B testimony has been completed. That's over and done with.
Okay, for the entire, yeah, let's need that for clarification.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Hoyt?
I certainly can't speak for the board, but I wanted to suggest so that there's no element of surprise here, and that people can be prepared, the parties can be prepared. There are two areas of interest which I will have, when appropriate, during the proceeding, one of which deals with the financial assurance which might be required by the board. Now, I understand that takes note of the board in order to do that. However, there is, under 74701, the financial assurance chapter, a method for estimating the amount of bond which might be required by the board. And I think that it might expedite proceedings. Mr. Main, if some preparation and thought could be given to that. Secondly, I will be interested in learning how PowerTech, the parent, intends to capitalize and fund the subsidiary PowerTech USA. Hopefully there will be a witness at an officer level who could speak to that.
And Mr. Chairman, I may. With regard to Mr. Freight's expressed interest in financial assurance, there are some federal laws and some statutes and rules that I need to make the board aware of, specifically with regard to that issue. Is it all right with the board that I add that to my brief, and that way all the parties have a chance to look at it also?
Please.
Yes, I think that would be very helpful. And
I believe part of the questions were, what effect do any of the federal process, any of the provisions have with the assurance provisions on it, indeed. So I think it's within the scope of it already. But that was at least one of the issues that was contemplated in the briefing request. And they were intentionally broad, in part because the board doesn't know what the party's positions are on various things. So if there's some restrictions, limitations, or something that needs to be presented to the board as to what they think the board's jurisdiction is, scope of authority, as well as jurisdiction, that should be presented on, and one of the areas was financial assurance.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may request, when PowerTech has identified the officer that they would intend to call on the questions raised
by Mr. Hoyt, if they could please notice us as soon as possible.
And if I can even do it by email.
Well, however you would want to do it, I just would request notice.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. Thank you, Mr. Allison. Anything else? Thank you for your courtesy and cooperation, everyone.